It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 587 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, February 24th, 2019. I am the Sala Monster on what may be one of, if not the biggest show I've ever done. It certainly looks like it could be with all the stuff I have to get through here. There's going to be a big episode this week. So many things to talk about. We have the return of Roman Reigns, kind of, which is causing people to lose their minds, if they even had them to begin with. I'm starting to wonder. Bruce Pritchard is back. We've got some early spring cleaning in WWE. Some people are no longer with the company. We have a bunch of random NXT call-ups on television this week. Kofi Kingston, we'll talk about him. China in the Hall of Fame. I'm going to cover all of it. Thank you first, though, to everybody who asked about my cat at the end of last week's show after what I was talking about. So, just to kind of let you in on what's been going on here the last, I don't know, 4 weeks or so. It's been kind of a rough time. And actually, it kind of reminds me a little bit too much of what me and my brother were going through this time last year with my mother. So that doesn't bring up some very happy memories. But unfortunately, it looks like my cat might have advanced lymphoma. I know she has a mass in her abdomen. You know, she's 17 years old, so there's no way the vet is going to put her under anesthesia, let alone operate on her. She's also anemic now, so we're trying different meds to sort of keep her energy up and to get her appetite back up, which is working. I mean, she's eating like crazy now, which is very encouraging. And the last vet visit was on Monday. I spent over half my day there. I was sort of mentally preparing for the worst, and I was relieved when they said that there were a few other things that we could try. So she's such a good cat. You know, cats can be jerks. Even I think cat owners would admit that. You know, this cat is as far from a jerk as you could possibly be. I don't think in 17 years I've ever heard this animal spit or hiss one time. Not once. She is just too good for this world. Now, I'll share a story with you real quick. I was still in college at the time, and I wanted to get my mother a cat for her birthday, because we had one when I was younger. It lived to 16, and it died, and she never got another one, over time, because I had become allergic. And I mean, I'm allergic to cats, dogs, horses, as I found out one day on a horse and buggy ride the hard way. And she wanted another one, but because of me, she couldn't get one. So in my infinite wisdom, I decided, I know what I'll do. I'll get her a cat. Figuring, well, I'm dorming away from home anyway, right? Who cares? Not realizing, yeah, you dipshit, but what are you going to do when you move back home for summer break? You know, or when you graduate? I wasn't thinking this through. I was sort of thinking the way that WWE books its television. But I remember, you know, being in the shop there, and I had one kitten on one shoulder, and it had another kitten, a black cat, on the other shoulder. And they told me to choose. You know, choose between the two of them. And I picked her. She's a domestic short-haired tabby. She was 6 weeks old at the time. And last year, before things really went south, my mother would worry a lot. She worried about everything. I called her the ultimate worrier, because that's all she ever did, was she worried. And she said, you know, make sure, no matter what, make sure you take care of Jinxie, because her name is Jinx. And it made me think, because I remember Jim Ross, after his wife died. It was so, that whole story was so sad. But when his wife died, it was only a few months later, and then he had tweeted out that his cat died. He said it really was his wife's cat, and that the cat died of a broken heart. That can happen with animals. I mean, that could happen with humans, too. So I was really worried, you know, after, you know, she died last year. Now I'm thinking, well, what's going to happen to the cat? We bought her new toys. I mean, this cat has more toys than I had as a kid. But she did fine. And now this is happening. So I have to give her B12 injections, you know, twice a week. I don't even like needles. I have to give her injections. You know, imagine having to stick one in your cat or your dog. It's not the most fun thing in the world to have to do. And, of course, you know, vet bills are not fun either. You know, until your pet gets sick, unless you have pet insurance. And really, how many people actually have pet insurance? I don't think I've ever known anybody who has had pet insurance. Until it's too late, and then they look into it, and of course, by then, there's no point. But you don't realize, until you're in that situation, how expensive these vet bills can be. So I've been reminded of that recently as well. But anyway, I'm happy to say, real quick here, last few days have been much better. And, you know, if that changes, then I guess I'll have to make a decision I don't want to make. I think that's the absolute worst part about being a pet owner. And it's the main reason why I'll never have another one after this. But I'd say the last 5 or 6 days or so has been a big improvement. So fingers crossed that we can keep this thing going for a while. Having to give her this steroid, this is the other thing I have to give her. I have to give her an oral steroid every night by mouth. This is a battle. I should film this. This is a battle. You would think that a 17-year-old sick cat would not be this strong. I'm starting to wonder if they gave me an anabolic steroid instead of whatever the hell it was they thought they were giving me. This cat probably wouldn't pass a piss test in WWE, I would think, right now. So this wrestling stuff, anyway, has been a nice distraction for me. And, you know, that, and also I've been working on a project that's very personal to me that I hope to be able to share with all of you by the summer. Hopefully I can make an announcement about it by then. This is your last shot in the month of February to take advantage of our Audible trial. You can get one free audiobook. Just go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. Sign up for their 30-day trial. You can sample the service and you get to download one free audiobook of your choice that belongs to you no matter what, even if you cancel the trial. If you do not want to use the service, you get to keep that book no matter what. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. You must sign up to get your free book on us. And if you want to make a PayPal donation, you could always do so on thesolomonster.com. Right-hand side of the page, you will see the PayPal button. Or you can send a donation to the main show email, thesolomonster@gmail.com. That works too. I want to say thank you. Of course, as you all know, $10 or more, nickname, shout out, you guys know the deal. Thank you very much to John Luz Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird Brian Pissera, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, Sean Nasty Boy Nilsson, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eicher, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Dirty from the 530, Gabriel Sanchez, Bonebreaker Justin Bridge, the Maniac Medic W.S. Fletcher, Recon Russell Bullware, Atlanta Fury, Duran Browning, Define Real, shout out to him, the Mixed Tag Team of Dan and Mary. They are fans of the podcast all the way in Germany. So I want to say hello to Dan and Mary. Matt, slap my patoot silly Scala. Matt just found out he's having a baby boy on the way. Up All Night, Charlie Matthew Scala. That's my name for him. Up All Night, Charlie Matthew Scala. As in, you're going to be up all night with this child. So get ready. And congratulations. Michael Sports Talk Santaniello. He and his best friend, they are college seniors who just started a new sports podcast called Controversial Calls, where they debate different sports. They bring a different guest on each week in a very casual setting. It's meant to feel like, you know, just friends sitting around at a bar chatting about sports. The only way to listen right now is on SoundCloud, so show them some love if you're a sports fan. Go to soundcloud.com/controversialcalls55. Episode 1 is up right now. Again, that's Controversial Calls 55 on SoundCloud. And shout out to Beatus666 Taco and Dallas Bolin on iTunes for showing some love to the podcast on there. All right, here we go. Time to piss some people off. WWE broke the news on Thursday that Roman Reigns will be returning to Raw this Monday night in Atlanta to address the fans on the status of his battle with leukemia, We have not heard from Roman Reigns, at least not on WWE television, since October 22nd. That is the episode of Raw where he came out and he made his announcement. He vacated the Universal Championship. He not only made the announcement about his cancer diagnosis, but the fact that he had had leukemia once before, which even very few people inside the company even knew. He has not shared exactly what type of leukemia that he has. There's different types. Some are more serious than others. But from the photos and the videos that I've seen of him since then, he looks pretty damn good for a guy going through leukemia treatment. He filmed some stuff with The Rock for his Fast and Furious spinoff that's due out this summer. That's that Hobbs and Shaw movie. He's filmed some other stuff. He's been keeping very busy. And then on Tuesday morning, after he makes his appearance on Raw tomorrow night, he's going to be appearing on Good Morning America on ABC to talk about his cancer fight. I cannot see this being anything but a positive update. There is no way that WWE is going to promote this appearance in advance like this and a GMA appearance to announce bad news. They're not going to have Wade Barrett come out, you know, before Roman makes his announcement, you know, and say he's got some bad news. I don't see that happening here, unless the man is retiring, and clearly he's not retiring. So I can't see this as being anything but a positive. My hope and my expectation is that he tells us that the treatment is working, or it has worked, and that he has achieved a remission, which would be fantastic. There is no greater feeling in this world than hearing that word. My mother achieved remission after the very first round of treatment for her leukemia. And the only thing that sucks, typically, is that even if you achieve remission right away, you know, after that first round of treatment, you still have to finish out your treatment. It's like taking an antibiotic, right? You can, if you're supposed to be on an antibiotic for 10 days, you can't take it for 4 days and say, oh, I feel better, I can stop taking it now. I mean, people do, but you're really not supposed to do that. You're supposed to finish out your course of treatment, whatever that may be. You know, and that could be a 6-month plan, it could be chemo, it could be radiation, it could be any number of things. Again, it's different for everybody. But there's this guy, his name is David Gagne, and he is the general manager of Island Club and Spa on Waikiki in Hawaii. He's been the GM there for the last 6 months or so, and he's worked there as a personal trainer for the better part of 5 years, at least according to his LinkedIn when I checked it out. He posted a photo that he took last week with Roman on his Instagram, because Reigns has been in Hawaii. I know he was filming scenes for that Hobbs and Shaw movie. Maybe now he's vacationing there. Not a bad place to hang out, I wouldn't think. And he's been training at Gagne's club. He's been training down there. In the photo, he looks great. Roman, physically, he looks great. Looks like he could get back in the ring tomorrow if he wanted to. Of course, that doesn't mean physically he's able to. He's not getting back in the ring tomorrow. But he looks to be in great shape. And in the caption, Gagne said that we are glad to have been able to provide a great space to help him prepare for his in-ring return. So there you go. I think it's pretty safe to say that he's doing well enough that he is already training for an in-ring return. I would think WrestleMania is, you know, obviously far too soon for that. In fact, in the comments next to the photo, if you scroll down, he's responding to a bunch of commenters. Gagne said as much. He said that, you know, Reigns is still recovering and is still a few months away from an in-ring return. He said that he was working out with him. He was definitely moving slowly. Look, I suppose you can't completely rule out WrestleMania. I would be shocked. I would guess it'll be sometime after Mania, you know, maybe even the summer. Maybe SummerSlam or something. They could build to a big return if he's ready to come back. This does not mean, by the way, that they cannot shoot an angle on television with him tomorrow night. You know, maybe even have a heel come out and interrupt him and get some heel heat. Brock Lesnar. Look, Brock Lesnar was scheduled to be on this show in Atlanta. At least as of 9 or 10 days ago. He was being advertised for Raw in Atlanta. Now, I no longer see his name listed on the website for the State Farm Arena, which is where the show is tomorrow night. When I looked yesterday, his name was not there. You would think if Brock was going to be on the show, they'd have his name listed there and advertised for the show. And now it's not. Now, that doesn't mean he won't be there, but it's very possible that plans changed and he won't be on the show this week after all. But let's say he is. You know, maybe Lesnar and Heyman interrupt Roman after Roman gives us his big medical update, and they use Roman as a way to help hype up the match between Lesnar and Rollins at WrestleMania. You know, maybe it's not even that. Maybe it's as simple as having Rollins and Dean Ambrose, who all of a sudden is a babyface again, come out to the ring after, you know, Roman shares his news with us. They come out to the ring for a segment. And look, again, if Ambrose is leaving, they're not going to have too many more chances to have a Shield reunion in the ring. You know, this could be one of the last Shield photo ops that we get. Maybe he'll announce that he's going to be at WrestleMania in some capacity as a guest. Maybe he'll be ringside for the Rollins match. Maybe he'll be a referee, but he could do any number of things. Maybe he'll just be there to support his good friend Seth Rollins. The bigger point is this. I'm happy that the man seems to be doing well. I'm happy the man is not dying. That'll hopefully be the big news coming out of this segment on Monday night. That's more important than any stupid, silly wrestling storyline or wrestling angle. And I'm hoping to hear the R word tomorrow night. And I'm not talking about retirement, all you wise asses out there. So I'm expecting a positive update. Which brings me to my last point. All the people I see online, especially when that picture got posted of him on Instagram at the spa, commenting that, well, of course, the whole thing was a work. Naturally, right? Just in time for WrestleMania. Here comes Roman Reigns. Look at him in that photo. He looks great. Of course, this whole thing was a work from the beginning. Him training for an in-ring comeback, him possibly being at WrestleMania. This is somehow proof that this was all just one big work from the very beginning. Believe it or not, these people actually do exist. I wouldn't believe it myself if I didn't see the comments with my own eyes. Now, I understand that Vince McMahon has done some pretty deplorable shit before. They've done a lot of tasteless, very classless things. Wrestling is a dirty business. It's not just Vince and WWE. I mean, we once saw Ric Flair fake a heart attack in the ring on Nitro. So I've gotten the question from people. Would you put it past WWE to do something like that? To work a cancer angle? To get Roman Reigns cheered when he returns? No, I don't think they would do that. I believe there is a line that they won't cross, and that's it. And the fact that there are still people who believe that they would have their top star that they have been building everything around for the last 4-5 years now go out in front of the world under his real name, not his character name. He didn't come out as Roman Reigns. They came out as Joe. Come out on television under his real name and tell people that he is battling this deadly disease, which kills thousands of people each and every year. And not only is he battling this potentially fatal disease, but that he's already fought it once before. That they would do that, that they would take him off of television, strip him of their top title first, which they had just waited months to finally crown him as their champion at SummerSlam. They beat him at WrestleMania. They beat him at that, whatever that, the greatest Royal Rumble was. He didn't win the title there. They waited and waited and waited. And finally, as his crowning moment at SummerSlam, that they would do that only to take the championship practically immediately off of him, then take him off television at a time when their ratings are as low as they've ever been. For 4 months, he's been off TV so far. That they would do all of that while working with Susan G. Komen. While working with Connor's Cure, that they would risk all of that and potentially risk being exposed and having the rest of the talent find out, talent who was crying their eyes out when they first heard the news, everybody was all broken up about it, and for the fans to possibly find out and their sponsors to find out, you have to be a special kind of stupid to take all of that into account and still think that this entire thing has been one elaborate work. You honestly believe that they would take that risk and clown around about cancer? You were born with a brain for a reason. Please use all of it and not just part of it. There's a difference between having a little bit of skepticism in the back of your mind, but being able to accept reality and just flat out being stupid. I mean, I am talking about some of the extreme ones that I have seen in the last 48 hours or so. I grabbed two of them that I saw. There were so many. I grabbed two of them that I saw. This was posted under Vince McMahon's official tweet the other day when he mentioned Roman was coming back to Raw. You got this one guy, what was it, Fierce Zitan. It was all a work to get the fans to cheer for him. I can't tell you how many times I saw that. But this one took the cake. This person here, he calls himself Roman Trash. Well, I mean, that tells you everything you need to know about this guy right there. This is what he said. He goes, I don't buy this shit at all. He leaves, he shows up at football games, and then he's making a movie with Dwayne. Like, what the fuck? Where are the chemo labs and blood work? I don't believe shit when it comes to Reigns. What are you, his fucking doctor? Show me his chemo labs and his blood work. Who the fuck are you? Who are you? You're nobody. Where are the chemo labs and blood work? I swear to God, some people are just too stupid to breathe. Too stupid to breathe. I want that guy to take a test of his own, an IQ test, and post the results so we can all see. I'd be shocked if he scores higher than a 20. But with a Twitter name like that, I guess I shouldn't be surprised. The level of hate and vitriol that I have seen, especially from these extreme examples, has really exposed a lot of people these last few days, and it's exposed a really ugly side of wrestling fans and the wrestling community. We always knew it was there, but every now and then it really bubbles up and reminds you of exactly what you're dealing with here. And the unfortunate part is that no matter what happens tomorrow night, if Roman comes out and announces anything other than just, you know, something negative, if it's anything positive at all, or I'm going to be appearing at WrestleMania, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, if he gets physical, if he takes a bump, if he does anything tomorrow night, it will not be enough to convince these people that this whole thing was a work from the word go. Anything like that that happens tomorrow night is going to be proof that this whole thing was a work and there's no convincing them otherwise. I hope the man is in good health. Whatever he may or may not do at WrestleMania, we'll see. Again, I don't see a match in the works here, but I take it as a positive sign that things are going well. He'll be able to come back one day, and he'll, even better, he'll be able to piss all of these people off all over again. I actually think this has made me more of a Roman Reigns fan. I actually cannot wait to see some of these people's heads explode when the man eventually comes back. That will bring me great joy to see that happen. From one big story to another, this came out of left field. PW Insider broke the news yesterday that Bruce Prichard is returning to WWE in a top position on the creative team starting this Monday in Atlanta for Monday Night Raw. They had a source describe his position as being as important as possible, and that it's going to be very similar to his previous role as one of Vince McMahon's right-hand men, basically one of Vince's consigliers, effectively. He has been doing the Something to Wrestle With podcast with Conrad Thompson now for a while. That really put him on the map. I mean, people kind of, I think wrestling fans had heard the name. They knew who Bruce Prichard was. He's been an on-air character in WWE and in TNA. But the podcast is what really popularized this guy and gave him new life in the wrestling business at a time when, you know, maybe he had been to a few places already, and who knew? Who knows, you know, what his future in wrestling would have been without the show. The show is really what gave new life to Bruce Prichard, if we're being honest here. You know, he ought to give Conrad 3/4 of his paycheck, whatever Vince is paying him, because it really has made him a hot commodity. He and Conrad, they go out on tour, they do live appearances, live podcasts together, so that's been a real big boon for him. Now, my initial thought when I saw the news, and this was only half joking, you know, what I put on Twitter, was that Vince must really be pissed at Conrad for getting Undertaker to do StarCast. And so, as an act of revenge, he went and snatched Prichard away from him. Now, that's only true if Prichard and Conrad stop doing their podcast And there's been no confirmation either way of whether or not that's going to happen. I would be shocked, frankly, if the podcast goes away. I don't see that happening. I think the show lives on in some form, even if it was just on the WWE Network. You know, they have their own version of the podcast. For a while, they did one season, and there's been some question if they were going to bring it back for a second season. At the very least, I think it would be something on the network, if not just a case where he could continue to do both. I just cannot see them ending the show as successful as it's been. But you got to remember something here. Creative is a very demanding job. You know, how many writers, how many people who have passed through the doors of WWE? I mean, my God, think of all the turnover they've had in creative in that company over the last 10 to 15 years. And we've heard people do interviews. We know how demanding of a job that can be, especially when you work directly for and under Vince McMahon. He is not an easy person to work for. It takes up a lot of your time. You've heard countless stories about phone calls in the middle of the night. Vince gets 3 or 4 hours of sleep every night, so therefore I guess everybody else should too. It takes up a lot of your time, but so does podcasting. I think people have this image in their head that you just, you know, you're 1 day a week or 2 days a week or whatever it is, or even if you do it every day, you just sit down, you push, you know, on the microphone and you just start talking, you know? And some people might do that. I wouldn't listen to those shows. You know, the shows that are really worth your time are the ones that put the effort in to actually prepare and research and put some notes together and know what they're going to talk about and have a plan. And, you know, it takes time out of your day to do all of that. Those show, and especially the shows that he and Conrad do. Yeah, you know, I've listened to a lot of them, not all of them, but you know, those shows they do can be longer than an episode of Monday Night Raw sometimes. Probably like this podcast today, with all the freaking news that there is to cover. I wouldn't be shocked if this show turned out to be 3 hours. But they put a lot of work into those shows. I know Bruce has to go back, he's got to watch old shows, go through his notes, maybe take some new notes on stuff. You know, sometimes on things that are 25, 30 years old. You know, he can't just remember everything off the top of his head. You don't just snap your fingers and voila, it's done. It's a time commitment, and you just wonder how much of one he'll be able to make if he's going to be working full-time in creative as one of Vince McMahon's lieutenants, basically. This is not a part-time gig. This is a full-time position, head-first, right into creative. You know, Pritchard first joined the company back in 1987. He was in and out of the company a few times. Some of that was his wife getting sick with cancer. He's told that story on his show before about having to relocate from Connecticut to Houston and, you know, work from home while she was getting treatment. And that, I'm sure, wasn't an easy thing. But aside from a few periods here and there where he was out or he was fired for whatever reason, he really has been with the company for the most part from 87 all the way through 2008, which is when Stephanie McMahon fired him. That's a whole story. I'm sure, you know, some of you may have heard that, the gun story. He was carrying a gun. I think he told this on the podcast a while back, at least his version of events. You know, if I remember, there was a hurricane. There was a hurricane coming through. He was living in Texas at the time. So this would have been after he moved down there, you know, for his wife's treatment. And there was a hurricane. He and his family were displaced for a while. And he was staying with JBL. And he didn't want to leave his gun in JBL's house. So he took it to work with him. Probably not the brightest thing in the world to do. But he took his gun to work. Some people found out about it. Somehow it got back to Stephanie that he pulled a gun on someone, or at least that's what Stephanie said. Stephanie called him and said, "Did you pull a gun on somebody?" And then a week later, he was fired. You know, she told him, "Look, I can't believe you brought a gun to work. Go home." And then a week later, she called him and said that he was fired. And this is going to be very interesting because one of the theories about this, and about that story, even about how Pritchard got fired, one of the theories is that Stephanie was just fishing for a reason to get rid of the guy. That he didn't actually pull a gun on somebody, but she was waiting for one reason to be able to cut this guy loose. Just like the rumors that when Vince finally goes, that Kevin Dunn is probably one of the first people to go because Triple H and Stephanie are going to replace him. And they're going to want to install their people. They're not going to want Vince's people. These guys that have been there in some cases for 20, 30, 40 years. They're not going to want the old guard. They're going to want their own people. You know, Kevin Dunn is one of Vince's people. Pritchard was one of Vince's people. Now Pritchard is back and in a pretty prominent role. This is clearly a Vince McMahon decision. I wonder what Triple H and Stephanie think. I wonder how they feel about all this. Is Bruce Pritchard the answer? It feels like a break glass in the event of an emergency type of move by Vince McMahon. Is he really the answer to their creative problems? Is the solution for them to look to the past in order to build for the future? You know, Bruce has had some good ideas over the years. He's had some not so good ideas over the years. But the key is that he knows how to work with Vince McMahon. He knows how Vince thinks. He knows what he likes. He knows what he dislikes. There's a lot of people, I'm sure, behind the scenes in that company who know what Vince likes and what Vince dislikes. The challenge, I think, I sense, is finding those people who aren't afraid to confront him on the things that he doesn't like if they think it's the right thing. Anybody can be a yes man and say, yes, Vince, no, Vince. How many people say no, Vince? Is he willing to do that? Because then that might be something. If he's just being, you know, installed to be a stooge and go along with whatever Vince McMahon wants, I don't really see what that accomplishes. At the end of the day, it's still Vince McMahon in charge. I'm skeptical that anything is really going to change. But you know what? A lot of what we see on TV, a lot of what we see on Raw primarily every single week, the way the show is laid out, it's so boring. I'm interested to see what, if anything, he adds to the show. If it's even noticeable. Or what might change about the show if he really does have that much power. I am so desperate for change on this show that I say, sure, why not? Although, I have to admit, when I first saw that headline, and the headline on the site was, Major Creative Name Returns to WWE, my heart sank. I thought it was someone else. I was relieved when I saw Bruce Pritchard's name. When he went to work for TNA the first time, and took over from Russo as the lead creative voice in the company, this would have been, I want to say, later in 2011, into the beginning of 2012. That was around the time that I started watching Impact full-time. I mean, I had watched Impact, but never really on a full-time, every single week basis. Not for many years, anyway. And that was the time around then when I finally got back into Impact on a week-to-week basis. In fact, I think it was the episode where Brooke Hogan made her debut. And I promise you, it was not because Brooke Hogan was coming to TNA. It just so happened that her debut is being promoted for that show. I want to say like May of 2012. But there was a period of about, I'd say, 6 months to a year, maybe even a little more, where I watched that show consistently every single week, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. Despite Aces and Eights and all that, which I wasn't a big fan of, I'll even go as far as to say that most weeks, TNA was better than what we were seeing on WWE television. What we were seeing on Impact was far better than what we were getting on Raw. And this is going back to when John Cena and CM Punk and those guys were the top names on the brand. Raw still wasn't all that great. It was better than it is now. But I would say that Impact was the superior show. Some people would say that now even. Although they're not nearly on as big of a network as they were back then. So if Pritchard had anything to do with that, and I think he did, I think he was probably overseeing things at the time and had a pretty heavy hand in creative, then you know what? I'm on board to give the guy another shot and see what he might be able to do. Because if he fails, Vince will just get rid of him again. It still feels like a panic move to me. I don't think it speaks very well to the fact that they have an army of writers working for them. And still, the old man doesn't think that's enough. He's got to dip back into his old bag of tricks to try to fix a problem that he himself created. The man in charge is still the same. Nothing changes in that respect. That's why I kind of laugh every time I hear a story like this about some big creative hire, some big creative move. And I think to myself in the end, what does it matter if the same person overseeing creative is the same man who has overseen creative for the last 30 plus years? You talk about wanting to bring new ideas and a new vision. I'm sure a lot of those people backstage have some pretty good ideas. Doesn't matter if they're filtered out and they can't break through to the man in charge. That's going to be the question. Let's see if anything actually changes. One thing I find encouraging is that I know from comments that he has dropped on his podcast that Pritchard is a fan. He's a fan of a few people, but he's a fan of Matt Riddle. And he thinks that Matt Riddle can be a huge star. I concur. On NXT this week, they aired part of a sit-down interview at the Performance Center with Riddle. It was conducted by Jeremy Borash, which I think is the first kind of interview they've had Borash do. Maybe they'll let him do more like that. What they aired on television was a condensed version of a longer interview on YouTube where he talks about wanting to be the man, and he's talked about this before, wanting to be the man to retire Brock Lesnar. He all but guarantees that it's going to happen. He's going to be the guy to retire Brock Lesnar from pro wrestling. I've said before, I think he should do it. I think he should be allowed to go ahead and work a program with Brock Lesnar or work a WrestleMania match or whatever and be the guy to have the distinction of retiring Brock Lesnar, whether it's a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. Matt Riddle should retire Brock Lesnar, and they should use that as a way to cement him as one of the top stars in the company. I actually think, I'm looking at when he signed and everything, and kind of the lay of the land right now in wrestling, I gotta tell you, I think he signed with WWE too early. You know, I was so hung up like a lot of people were for so long. How come WWE isn't signing this guy? He's working with Evolve and all these different promotions, and it was like they were dancing around him. They were signing all these other people. They wouldn't sign Riddle. And I knew about the pot thing, and I said, this guy is too talented. You can't tell me they're not signing him just because of that. You can't tell me there aren't people in WWE getting hit with a pot tax every single week. Why are they not signing this guy? I said that for the longest time, and now I'm looking at it. You know what? Maybe he signed too early. When you look at the state of the wrestling scene right now with Ring of Honor and AEW and the money that these people are throwing around, I don't know what WWE is paying Matt Riddle, but I guarantee you if he would have held out just a little bit longer, a few more months, a guy like him, he could have been clearing two or three times what he probably signed for. But if Pritchard has creative influence and can play a role in Riddle getting a big push on the main roster, you know what? I'm all for it. It was Black Friday for WWE talent releases this week, some by their own request, others not so much, but none of whom were wished well in their future endeavors. Ty Dillinger, start with him, he announced on social media late Tuesday night after SmackDown that he requested his release from WWE. He was very complimentary towards them. He said he felt the decision is what was best for him and for the company. He said he wants to continue to grow as a performer. He thanked all the coaches, the producers, the ring crew, all the way up to the very top. On Friday, WWE made it official. They granted his wish, and they gave him his release. I think it was actually, whether he intended this or not, I think it was a very shrewd move on his part, because it put the ball very publicly, squarely in WWE's court, when he made public the fact that he requested his release. He didn't announce that he was released. He just said, I want everybody to know that I have gone to WWE and I have requested that they release me. And now let me say all of these wonderful things about them and butter them up so they'll give me what I want. And in the end, he got it. Because look, if WWE didn't give him his release, they would come off looking like jerks, which I guess hasn't stopped them before. But I thought that was a very shrewd move on his part. And look, we all knew the writing was on the wall for this guy when he went months without appearing on television. And I know he only recently came back. He was recovering from surgery on his hand. He had surgery in the fall. But it wasn't as though, even before that, they were doing much with him. You know, the writing was on the wall a week or two ago. I think I may have even featured him as sad tweet of the week when a fan suggested that, hey, why don't you go back down to NXT? And you know, get some more time down there if they're not doing anything with you. And his response was, I tried. He asked to go back to NXT and his request was denied. That should have been a telltale sign right there. NXT is where this guy found his greatest success after, I mean, look, he had a pretty lackluster run in WWE. He was first signed to a developmental deal in 2006, 13 years ago. And in those 13 years, this guy's greatest success was throwing his fingers up in the air and shouting 10. Not taking away the fact that he's a very good wrestler, But he had no real success until the 10 gimmick. I think we need to be realistic about what this guy's ceiling was going to be in that company. It was pretty low. They still could have done a better job, I think, of capitalizing off the popularity that he did have. I think they squandered that. You know, as usual, they didn't seem to have much of a plan when they called him up. Beyond the clever spot at the Royal Rumble a couple of years ago when he came out in the number 10 spot, he got one of the biggest reactions of anybody that night in the Alamo Dome. They never pushed him seriously because they clearly never had any intention of doing so. You know, when he was originally in developmental, he was in OVW, he formed a tag team with Cody Rhodes. This is when Cody was brand new to the business. They won the tag team titles together. And then Dillinger turned heel, and he feuded with Cody until Cody got called up, and Dillinger was left behind. And eventually he got called up to the ECW brand. He came up under the name Gavin Spears. He had been Sean Spears previously. They said, no, we got to put our own spin. We'll call him Gavin. So he became Gavin Spears. He lost a handful of matches. He got hurt, and then he got cut. And it took 4 years, but he got the call back. He ended up in NXT. He came up later on with the Perfect 10 gimmick, and it just took off, and it was another 4 years from the time that he landed in NXT to the time he made it back to the main roster. It took four more years just to get him on television. And yeah, you know, he had a few matches with AJ Styles and Shinsuke Nakamura, but he was never focused on. And the 10 thing just started to die down. Just like, you know, Rusev Day, all these things, they run their course. That's why the key is to capitalize on them when they're hot. Do something with them when they're hot. See if they can sustain it. Maybe they can. Maybe they are a one-trick pony. But they never took full advantage of it. They never did much with the guy. That was it. That was the beginning of the end for him. I think he could have been. He could have gotten to that U.S. title level. There's no reason why he couldn't have done that. But honestly, that's about as high as I think he was going to go no matter what. He's not somebody they were ever going to build around. And maybe he shouldn't be. But he is another example of a talent that they just did not have a place for. They called him up and they had no plan in mind for him. And every time I say that about a WWE talent, you know, when they're called up from NXT, I think back to the time that Triple H made the comment. It was probably on one of those takeover conference calls. And, you know, when he made that statement that, well, we don't want to call people up unless we've got a plan in place. I want to make sure we have a plan in place for X number of months. We don't just want to call people up cold and have nothing for them. That may be how Triple H wants to run things, but that's clearly not how Vince McMahon runs things. Having a plan in place first. That much was patently obvious after that last batch of NXT call-ups in January. Cody did chime in on this when he heard the news about Dillinger. He said he cannot wait to see what he has in store next. He told Ryan Satin that he's been getting messages from people already, asking, when is Ty coming to AEW? Bring him into AEW. Cody, this is a guy who Cody once called the greatest human being alive. So clearly he thinks the world of him. Dusty Rhodes once said that, you know, when he was working down in NXT, that he thought that Dillinger should have been called up to the main roster years ago. So we know how Cody feels about this guy. It is worth pointing out that time-wise, now that he got his release, he's got 90 days to sit at home before he can make his next move. That 90 days runs out just a few days before that Double or Nothing show in Vegas. And they've already announced for that show they're going to have another one of those over-budget or over-the-budget battle royals like they did it All In, which I actually thought was a lot of fun. That'd be a good place to debut him as a surprise if they wanted to bring him into the company. You know, if he does go there. I think in an AEW or something, a guy like Dillinger, I think, could be a great utility guy for them to have. They do need to be careful, though, about one thing. They have to be careful, I think, not to come off like TNA did for a while as being the place where all of the WWE mid-card guys and all of the WWE cast-offs go to play. You know, AEW becomes their new sandbox and all these low to mid-card guys can just, you know, get cut or ask for their release and they'll kind of run off to All Elite Wrestling. They have to be careful because, you know, you kind of start to build a perception after a while that you're just sort of picking up the scraps. But I think he would be a good utility guy for them to have. Not somebody who can move the needle, but not everybody can play that part. I never saw him at that level. But there was no reason to hold the man hostage if he was unhappy. Let him go feel fulfilled somewhere else instead of just collecting a paycheck. Hideo Itami, he finally got his release this week. He had asked for it weeks ago. He had already said his goodbyes to everybody. WWE even posted video, I think, on their YouTube channel of him going around and hugging people and saying goodbye, so we knew this was coming. He was very well liked, but he got bit by the injury bug, kind of like Dillinger did in a way. Although that wrist, that hand injury is the only one I know of, but Itami had a couple of different injury situations going on, and really he was never the same after that. There was clearly no upward mobility for him on the roster. Now he can return, as he said he will, on Twitter. He's going to go back to his old Kenta name. Kenta is back. My guess is he'll go back home to Japan. Probably to Noah. I mean, that's really where he made a name for himself, Pro Wrestling Noah. But, you know, I don't know if New Japan would be an option for him. If that might be something that, he, you know, they would be interested in and he would be interested in. We'll see. We'll see. But I don't think that his career is over. I think he could still have a lot of success. WWE just didn't work out. He wasn't a good fit. Like I said, he got hurt. He clearly was not going anywhere. Why keep the man around if he's not happy? So now he is a free man. Or at least he will be again in maybe 90 days or so. TJ Perkins. Now we get to the crew who was not let go of their own volition. We get to TJ Perkins first. TJ Perkins was also released, unlike Dillinger and Itami. This was not something that he requested. On Twitter, he said that the boss, that being, I assume, Vince, not Sasha Banks, said that he respected his effort, he respected his diligence in terms of offering ideas and things of that nature, but it just didn't fit with what they wanted. That's what he was told. He said it wasn't my call, this was their call, and what I was offering was not what they wanted. In other words, he was fired. Now, this wasn't surprising to me after that tweet storm he went on after or during Raw last Monday. He accused someone behind the scenes. I don't know if he was accusing a writer. I don't know if he was accusing a talent. I assume a writer. But he accused somebody behind the scenes of, literally in his words, stealing an idea that I wrote. I guess for his own character is what he was referring to. That instead ended up being used for Ricochet, when Ricochet came out to make the save for Finn Balor. He said, I thought someone else turning in my homework with their name on it ended in high school. That's what he said in one of his many tweets. And when somebody tweeted to him to say, you'll get there one day, he responded by saying, no, I won't. That was my best shot. The rest is out of my hands. I'm doing my best, I promise you, but they won't let me off the bench, and they just gave the bat that I carved myself to someone else for their at-bat. And then when someone jokingly asked him, they said, so, when are we going to be seeing you in AEW? He said, well, if it were up to me, literally never. I'm doing everything I possibly can to succeed here on the team that I always wanted to play for, both on and off camera. Well, it looks like WWE didn't much care for those tweets. And despite his insistence that WWE is the only place he ever wanted to work, they got rid of him anyway. You know, look, it takes a lot these days, I feel like, to get WWE to fire you. They don't really do that much anymore like they used to, where they just indiscriminately cut people. I mean, it happens from time to time, but, you know, like this week, a lot of people left, but not all of them were fired. You know, a handful of them requested their release and they were granted it. It was something they wanted. It was something they asked for. But these days, they just sort of hold on to people until their contract runs out to keep them from going somewhere else. But here's a guy, you know, in TJP, TNA, also told him they weren't renewing his deal when it came up for expiration, and they fired him. They let him go. It's very odd to me that he was cut by both companies. He's a talented guy. I don't think anybody can deny that. TJ Perkins is a very talented guy, and you know, I was rooting for him in the Cruiserweight Classic. He was one of the stars of that thing. I think the only reason he won is because Kota Ibushi didn't sign a contract. I think if Kota Ibushi signed a contract with WWE, he would have been a shoo-in to win that thing and not TJP. But he's a talented guy. There's no doubt about it. It's just very bizarre to me that a guy like that would be cut by two different companies, two of the biggest companies like that. You know, the TNA thing, I don't even know if I really fault him for that completely. If I remember, he was very frustrated by some creative decisions that were made. I think they had him wearing a mask again, maybe after it had already come off. And he just wanted to be himself. Everybody knew who he was already. That's when Douche Magouche over there, Josh Matthews, tweeted at him, telling him, just go away. Just go. Enough. Tag all the Impact executives and just leave if you're not happy. But he had to know. Perkins had to know the risk he was taking when he posted those tweets this week. And, you know, look, it's one thing to post stuff online like that if you're somebody higher up on the card. Some guys are just bulletproof. TJ Perkins is not bulletproof. And to post the kind of things that he did when somebody down low on the card like him starts making waves. I mean, look, here's a guy who hasn't won a match since September. You know, he's clearly not a priority for them. And when a guy starts posting stuff online and making waves, you're just asking for them to do something, and they did. So you got Dillinger, you've got a Tommy, and you've got TJP. All gone. All talented guys, but these were low to middle of the card acts. I don't think the company will flinch without them. At a time when, frankly, this company is stockpiled with talent right now. They have too much talent. So much so, they don't know what to do with much of it. They could stand, in my opinion, they could stand to cut more people. They could cut another 5 to 10 people. I'm not going to name names and single anybody out because I'm not advocating for people to lose their jobs. But, you know, when I look at this from like a company perspective, they have way more talent than they can use right now. With more coming in. Not even 2 weeks ago, they announced their latest class of recruits to the Performance Center. ACH is in there. Trevor Lee was in there. Rachel Ellering was in there. And don't forget that Kushida is likely on his way in as well. They might be saving him as a surprise, which is why he wasn't photographed with the rest of the group. WWE could stand to trim some more fat off that bone. And then there's Arn Anderson. Arn Anderson was also let go this week. Arn Anderson was fired. And this one was a shocker. He had been working backstage as a producer for the company since WCW went under in 2001, Dave Meltzer on his website's message board was responding to people, and he said that Arn and Vince had a shouting match. Vince then sent him home and decided, in his words, never to bring him back. And then on his radio show, I think last night, I saw some notes here. I didn't listen to it yet, but on his radio show, Meltzer mentioned that flat out, Arn got fired. There was an incident. A lot of people are keeping quiet as to exactly what it was about, but it was an incident involving Vince McMahon. There are people who are siding with Arn Anderson, and there are people who are siding with Vince McMahon. And he doesn't have the full details yet. I'm sure it'll come out of what the incident was about, other than it was something at a house show that happened and apparently was not handled very well, and Arn took the blame for it. He took the heat for it. Kind of like when Fit Finlay took the heat for something completely stupid that happened a number of years ago, and they fired him for it. Now, eventually they brought him back, but that was that whole thing. I think it was a house show, and it was his decision to allow a segment where The Miz interrupted. I think it was the Star Spangled Banner or the National Anthem or something, and there were some army or military folks in the crowd, and you know, I think the U.S. Army is a sponsor for WWE. And they weren't happy, and they raised a stink about how can you interrupt the singing of the national anthem. And, I mean, again, that's something that's been done how many times for heel heat and wrestling over the years? Finlay wasn't trying to be an evil person. He got fired for that. So I'm very curious to know what this incident was. Was this really a big deal, or is this something very petty and stupid? I would suspect that those details will leak at some point, and we'll find out. But according to Meltzer, you know, Arn and Vince were already not on the best of terms. There had been other examples of incidents over the years that had occurred. And, you know, Arn is a guy who was very well liked by a lot of people, including some of the top stars in the company. People like Triple H, John Cena. Apparently he was John Cena's agent whenever John Cena did anything on television. Arn was his go-to guy. It's also worth noting, I think, that WWE posted this week a YouTube video introducing us to their new batch of backstage agents or producers, whatever they're calling them these days. They showed Jeff Jarrett, Abyss, Shane Helms, Sanjay Dutt, and Sean Daivari. Lots of new blood behind the scenes. If you can consider Jeff Jarrett to be new blood, I kind of chuckle when I say that out loud. But they let, you know, Arn Anderson go in a week where they introduced all of these new, you know, backstage agents. Again, one may not have anything to do with the other. It could just purely be whatever this incident and shouting match was with him and Vince. But you got to think Vince looks at the situation also and says, this guy is expendable. We have all these new people. We don't have to keep him around. He did something that obviously pissed Vince off. Fuck this guy. And he fired him. And you know, we're not going to skip a beat because we've got Jeff Jarrett. We've got Sanjay Dutt. You know, fuck Arn Anderson. Well, we have all these other new guys now. You know, and they let him go the week before Ric Flair's birthday party on television. Ric actually had a 70th surprise birthday party. Some footage is online. It's actually pretty cool. There were a lot of names there. Evander Holyfield was there. Charles Barkley was there. Triple H and Chris Jericho were there posing for photos together, which was wild. I saw the knobs of the Nasty Boys probably stuffing his face with stuff in the background at some point. A lot of people, Ricky Steamboat, a lot of people showed up at this party. But the televised version of Ric Flair's 70th birthday party, the non-surprise version of Flair's birthday party, is, of course, taking place on Raw tomorrow night. And we already know one person who won't be there, and that's Arn Anderson. Yeah, I know he and Ric are not as tight as they used to be. Something to do with Arn's wife being good friends with Ric's second wife. When Ric and her divorced, then Arn had to, I guess, pick a side, and he chose to side with his wife and Rick's ex. And I think that was sort of when things went south a little bit between them. I mean, they may be cool now, but I think people in their mind have this image in their head that still Flair and Anderson, they're like bosom buddies and best friends, and they still run around like it's, you know, the Horsemen in 1988. And that's just not the case anymore. But I don't know if there's a role for him somewhere else or, you know, if he even wants that, but he's the kind of guy who, when he talks, you listen. You know, I saw that up close when I interviewed him and Tully, and even at the Hall of Fame, you know, when the Horseman got inducted that year, he got a standing ovation before he even spoke, before he even uttered a word. That's respect. I can only imagine what he must have done or said for Vince to never want to bring him back again. I mean, that's like Randy Savage-esque treatment right there, you know? At least for Arn, he's already in the Hall of Fame, right? Savage didn't get in until he was dead. At least Arn had the chance to go up on stage and you know, get a nice ovation and make a great speech. And so it doesn't matter what Vince thinks now. You know what? Maybe Vince found out that AA is scheduled for StarCast. He is, actually. He really is scheduled for StarCast. Maybe Vince is taking this StarCast thing way too seriously. Speaking of the Hall of Fame, D-Generation X was announced as the headline attraction for this year's WWE Hall of Fame class. Triple H, Shawn Michaels, X-Pac, Road Dogg, Billy Gunn, and yes, China will all be inducted together Saturday, April 6th. That's at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. This makes Shawn Michaels a two-time Hall of Famer. Michaels was already inducted back in 2011. Look, if Bret Hart does go in for the second time this year, you knew that Shawn was going in too. I mean, that should have been a no-brainer. For Triple H, this will be his first induction officially, which I think is stupid. I think a big name like him should get their own solo induction first. Then if they want to do faction inductions, he could go in again later on. So this one just feels like it's ass backwards, but, you know, look, they need names. They need to sell tickets. They need an attraction. DX is an attraction. Waltman is a worthy entry, I think, from his early days in Global, I think it was, as the Lightning Kid. He made a name for himself. He was doing some pretty innovative stuff for that time, and it got him noticed. It got him a job in WWE at a time when there really were not very many people who looked like him. Today, he'd be in NXT, and nobody would think twice about it. That match with Razor Ramon on Raw in 93, the first one they had, not the rematch where he almost killed himself on the dive out of the ring. That match is one of the all-time greatest upsets in wrestling history. That's how you do an upset. That's how you work an angle like that. They did that to perfection. They made him a name. They made him a star in one night. They made that kid a star. He had a solid run there through the early part of 96. Went to WCW. He was part of the NWO. He did benefit from being friends with all those guys, you know, Hall and Nash and Triple H, you know. But I don't want to sit here and say the only reason that he became a name in the business is because of who he was friends with. It certainly helped. But I think to say that would take away from the fact that he was a talented guy who did benefit. But he was a talented guy who I think would have done, you know, pretty well for himself either way. But yes, absolutely, he benefited from who his pals were, and he was part of two of the biggest factions in the history of the business. He was part of the NWO, and he was part of DX. You know, that doesn't happen unless he's pals and buddies with those guys. He came back to WWE in 98 at a very opportune time when the company was finally starting to turn the tide against WCW, and he became a very big key part of the Attitude Era. He was one of those characters, those character performers. He wasn't a top guy in the company. But then after you get past Austin, Rock, Foley, Undertaker, Kane, and Triple H, then you start getting into the other cast of characters that people remember as being important pieces of that Attitude Era. And you think of the New Age Outlaws. You think of X-Pac. You think of China. You think of The Godfather. You think of, you know, different people like that who gained a lot of you know, fame and notoriety, and maybe they were only a mid-card act in some cases, but boy, everybody was over back then. It felt like everybody was over. Everybody had a gimmick or a character or a story of some kind, and it was just the product was so hot that, you know, and they were a little looser, obviously, with what they could get away with on TV. Just everybody felt like a star. So he really, you know, benefited from that as well. He came back, he joined the second iteration of DX. I don't think we're going to be getting any footage of him dressed in blackface as Mark Henry at the ceremony. I think they'll conveniently, you know, lose that footage. There's also his partnership with Kane, which I was a big fan of. I love the Kane and X-Pac tag team. He got Kane to speak his very first words on TV without the voice box. The Outlaws, one of the great teams in company history. Also a very big part of what people remember from that Attitude Era time period. They tried a singles push with Billy Gunn. Boy, did they try. He won the King of the Ring. Yeah, later on he won the IC title. They had big plans for him. It just didn't work. It did not work. His best run was as part of DX, as one of the New Age Outlaws. And even later, he did well as part of another tag team on SmackDown. Him and Chuck, Billy and Chuck. So, you know, Billy had way more success as a tag team wrestler than he did as a single. Road Dogg actually had a run with the hardcore title. That was very brief, but memorable for me. I was a fan of it. If I remember correct, I think he won the championship. I think he beat Al Snow with a pile driver outside the arena in the snow, if I'm remembering correctly. I do miss those hardcore title defenses. That was one of my guilty pleasures of that era. And then there's China. China finally gets her recognition in the Hall of Fame that I know people have been clamoring for years. People already in other circles bitching. What else is new? Bitching about her not going in on her own. Look, Triple H did an interview this week and flat out said that he thinks China deserves one day to go in on her own. So they're not closing the door. It is possible that it could happen. But even if it does, it probably isn't happening for a long time. If you're one of these people who desperately wanted to see China in the Hall of Fame and desperately wanted to see her get that recognition that you feel she deserved that she wasn't getting, be happy. She's going in. Enjoy it. Savor it. And guess what? She's going to have five other people on that stage saying nice things about her instead of just one. I remember her debut attacking Marlena out of the crowd, and I think it was the next night on Raw, and he's ragdolling her around. And when the product got real hot in 98 into 99, she was one of the hottest acts in the entire company. China was just beyond popular. More so than even a lot of the men were. Now, I think Sable was a bigger star in terms of the women, or when you think back to that period, stars of the Attitude Era, I would argue that for a time there, Sable was a bigger star than Chyna was. She really was the only woman more popular than Chyna at that time. But Chyna at one point was the number one contender for the WWF title. Heading into SummerSlam in 99, she was, for at least a week, the number one contender for the WWF Championship. She lost her shot on television to Mankind. Mankind went to SummerSlam instead, and then they ended up doing a triple threat. But again, for at least a week on TV, they were promoting a title match between Chyna and Stone Cold Steve Austin. What a match that would have been. But that's how big of a deal that this woman was at that time. And when she passed away, Austin on his podcast was really broken up about it. And he was saying, look, her going into the Hall of Fame one day isn't enough. This is what Austin said. They could put her in the Hall of Fame one day, and that still won't be enough to honor her. He said it wasn't right that she would go in one day only after she died because she couldn't be there to enjoy it. Someone should have told him what Triple H said about searching for her on Google. What about the kids, Steve? What about the kids? I hope they don't Google Sean Waltman and some of the shit that he did. Actual shit, too. Literal shit. She became the first woman to ever win the Intercontinental Championship, became the first woman to win the IC title twice, first woman ever to enter the Royal Rumble match. She did not leave the company on the best of terms. I think that is safe to say. She ended up in New Japan for a brief stint. One of the only women ever, maybe the only woman ever, to compete inside of a New Japan ring. Maybe, again, I can't be sure about that. Maybe at some point they had some kind of a women's match as some kind of attraction. But as far as I know, she's certainly one of the only women to ever set foot in a New Japan ring, aside from whoever... Whatever lady Yujiro brings to the ring with him. And, yeah, I know this Hall of Fame induction really is focused on her. Obviously, they're not going to mention any of this. And I know that this Hall of Fame induction is really focused and centered on her time as a member of DX. But since she may never get another induction and they ain't going to mention New Japan anyway, I think it's worth mentioning, you know, her entire career here, because I don't know that too many people even know that she wrestled in New Japan. Not only did she wrestle matches in New Japan, she wrestled this young guy named Tanahashi. I don't know, I think he may have gone on to have a decent career. But if you ever want to see something truly bizarre, just like a very bizarre sight, it's up on Daily Motion. I would imagine it's up also on New Japan World if you have a subscription. There was a tag team match in 2002. So while Ruthless Aggression was going on in WWE... In 2002, this was months before Big Papa Pump made his big debut at the Survivor Series, there was a match in New Japan pitting the Steiner Brothers. So yeah, Big Papa Pump looking like as only he can, but he's back to teaming with his brother, against the team of Hiroshi Tanahashi and Kensuke Sasaki at the Tokyo Dome. And Chyna, in her Chyna gear, is the special guest referee for that match. What a weird scene that was. The first time I saw it, I just brought it up again last night. I'm looking at this. And Chyna's the referee. I'm like, how did this ever happen? How did this ever happen? It's just very weird to watch. We all know about this woman's addictions. We all know that she's been a mess. She's been a train wreck in the past at different points. She's been on reality shows and a lot of embarrassing situations for her. And... look, it's worth noting, she lobbed some very serious accusations against Triple H, claiming that he hit her, he physically abused her, and even worse, against Sean Waltman. She lobbed some pretty serious accusations against both of them. At a time when it seemed like her head wasn't on straight, who's to say whether it's true or not, the fact that she wanted to apologize later on, at least to Triple H for what he had said... probably is a sign that she regrets saying anything. But now that seed has been planted, right? We can never be sure if it happened or not. And imagine if you're Triple H, if it never happened, now this accusation is out there forever that you physically abuse somebody. If I were him, I'd be pretty upset about that. But she did. She tried to, you know, she was trying to get her life together before she died, it seemed. it's a shame what happened to her. I mean, as far as the accusations and all that stuff, look, it's not hard to see why WWE would want nothing to do with this woman. It's sad on the one hand, but on the other hand, when she's out there saying the things that she was saying about, yeah, this guy's going to run the company one day, and you're making these kinds of accusations against him without any kind of proof. I never heard that story before. It's like out of the blue, all of a sudden, there's this story out there. You can understand why the company would want to distance itself from somebody like that. It's not hard to see. But she was trying to get her life together later on, and you know, for all of her demons and all of her issues and addictions, she did seem, underneath all of that, she seemed like a genuinely nice person. And Mick Foley and all these people who ever interacted with her would say the same thing. You know, they knew the real Joanie, and she was such a wonderful woman, and it makes it even sadder what happened to her. The fact is, all that stuff, all the bad stuff too, it doesn't minimize her role and the impact that she had on DX. As popular an act as that was in the company, a big part of that was China. You cannot put DX in the Hall of Fame without including China. And there have been multiple versions of DX over the years. I hated the later ones with Triple H and Shawn Michaels. I mean, some of the backstage segments were amusing that they did. I laughed at a few of them, but you know, that PG, like 2006 or whatever, 2009 version of DX, that was a channel changer for me. I never liked that. My favorite version was the post-WrestleMania 14 version, version 2, I guess, of DX, where Triple H took over and X-Pac joined and they had the Outlaws in there. It was Triple H, X-Pac, the Outlaws, and China. That was my favorite incarnation of DX. One of the greatest factions of all time. In fact, I had them in number 3. Late last year, I did my list of the top 10 factions of all time, and I had DX at number 3 when I ranked them. I had DX behind only the NWO and the Four Horsemen in the number 1 spot. That's a pretty good company to be in, I would say. I know this happened earlier in the week, but I didn't get a chance to comment on it. On Twitter I did, but not on the podcast, so indulge me for a few minutes if you would. Paige is on tour right now doing media for her new movie, Fighting With My Family. I see this movie is getting great reviews. Last I checked, it had over 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is great. I have no plans to see it. For the half dozen people who tweeted me asking if I plan on reviewing it, I think I replied to most of you, but if I didn't, I have no plans to review this. Maybe if it pops up on Netflix at some point. It takes a lot to get me to go to the movies these days. I generally cannot stand the people there. I said to somebody, though, I said, if the Cloverfield Monster was in this movie, I would probably go see it. So if he's in it, let me know. Anyway, she gave an interview to this outlet called Gulf News, and she talked about the women's revolution in WWE. And she gave us a preview of the sequel to her movie, I guess, which she's going to call Fighting With My Fans. She set off a bit of a firestorm with her claim that it was the fans, not WWE, it was the fans, holding the women back all these years. I'll give you a second to compose yourself after hearing that. Here's her exact quote. I want to make sure that she's not being misquoted. I know she's since tried to explain herself, but this was the original quote in the interview, okay? This is not taken out of context here. She said, it was never WWE holding the women back. It was the fans not taking them seriously. They wanted to see more of the male characters many years ago. It was a male-dominated sport. When I first started, there were only 5 women there. It was a struggle, but WWE just believed in us. When I got into the ring, I wanted to prove to the fans that the girls were capable of having good matches and sometimes even better. That was kind of my mission from the get-go. Now, obviously, there's a revolution. That's what she said. Let me repeat those first 2 sentences for you. It was never WWE holding the women back. It was the fans not taking them seriously. Aha. I see. Now, she has since walked that comment back, because of course she has. She probably wouldn't say that she's walked the comment back, but if you look at some of the tweets that she posted in response to a couple of fans several days ago, in one case, she said, Even up to a few years ago, certain places we would wrestle in, the fans in big arenas would chant boring at the girls, or they would do the wave, or for years they chanted, we want puppies. So she said it was absolutely a mixture of both. Which is true. But that's not what she said. Her exact quote was, it was never WWE. Now she says, well, it's a mixture of both. Yes, it is. It is a mixture of both. You did have a lot of fans who did not give these women a chance and chanted awful things at them. Absolutely, the fans are not blameless. But that's not what she said. She literally used the word never. It was never WWE holding the women back. Which, of course, is complete and utter bullshit. This is the same company that once gave Natalya a farting gimmick on television. And they wonder why the fans don't take the women seriously. Gee, I wonder why. For years, they conditioned their audience not to like take the women seriously. Bra and panties matches. I remember one time on TV, they did this thing. It was called the over-the-top, off-with-your-top match. Hiring big-breasted women out of modeling catalogs. I mean, that was great. Hey, look, as a male teenager, hey, it's the greatest thing in the world. But that was their choice. To put that stuff on television, and even years later in the 2000s, again, they were picking people out of modeling catalogs. They were looking at people in their thongs and in their bathing suits and picking out wrestlers based on how they looked in magazines. They didn't know the first thing about wrestling. Didn't matter. That's not what the company was looking for. Suddenly, these women are on television, in the ring, and the fans are supposed to take them seriously? They took it for what it was. It was tits and ass entertainment. That's what it was supposed to be. And I'm not talking about Dixie Carter's company. You know, I get it. Sex sells. I get that. That's why WWE did it. That, and you've got a bunch of hornballs working behind the scenes. I think we know that too. But yeah, Michelle McCool did an interview once talking about how her and Layla got yelled at backstage after a match for being better than the guys. Chris Jericho was standing nearby. He heard the whole thing. He came over, he laced into this guy. I don't know who this guy was, but he laced into this guy. He said, look, if they're better than the guys, maybe the men need to step it up. It's not their fault. Imagine telling your women, hey, you're too good, stop that. You're showing up the men. But imagine, like, oh, you're too good. Stop doing that. And then years later, having the fucking gall to say, oh, it was never WWE holding them back. It was the fans. It was the fans' fault. The fans are to blame. I guess the fans were also to blame for all those times that the women's matches on TV got their time cut right before they went out through the curtain. I guess that was our fault, too. All those times the women got to the ring and were literally told, as they got to the ring, go home. It's time to go home. When the match hadn't even started yet. They were told sometimes to go home before the bell rang. We need more time for this gas bag, whoever it is, this gas bag of the week to go in the ring and Blovier during his shitty promo. You women need to go home. Take this match home. But that's our fault. It's our fault. It's your fault. It's my fault. They had a man win the first ever women's Money in the Bank match. You know who came up with that crap idea? We did. That was all on us. My bad. I'm sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. Never in my life have I seen a sport or a form of entertainment that so openly despises its own fans and openly mocks them, calls them marks. That tweet from Goldust from last year, your opinion ain't worth a thin dime. You know he can't be the only one who thinks that way. Sad tweet this week. Actually, I've got three of them. I'm going to spread them out throughout the show. Sabu, by the way, I saw Sabu had his Twitter account suspended. Apparently he tweeted some homophobic shit. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. I guess wishing death on Jim Ross a few months ago wasn't enough. But this was the last straw. Fuck him. But this one was so random, I laughed so hard when I saw it. So Eva Marie. You all remember Eva Marie, right? All red everything. I've seen her recently talking about how she has unfinished business and she wants to possibly come back to WWE in the future. Anyway, she posted a tweet that she could not wait to chit-chat with this woman, Jessica Graff, I guess her name is, on Jessica's podcast. Fairly innocuous tweet. That's all she was saying. I can't wait to go on this woman's podcast and talk to her. Out of nowhere comes Scott Hall, who tweets the following in response. Don't show up then, you dumb fuck. Well, that was uncalled for. I have no idea what that was all about. Unless he accidentally replied to the wrong person. I'm not sure how you do that. That's the only explanation that I could come up with. It's still up, last I checked. He didn't correct it. He didn't explain it. So I assume it was meant for her. Poor Eva Marie. Monday Night Raw was live from the graveyard last Monday night. I'm sorry, not the graveyard. Lafayette, Louisiana. Lafayette, Louisiana. I want whatever those people were on last Monday. You could have had Vince McMahon come out to announce that Stone Cold Steve Austin was coming out of retirement to drive a beer truck up Baron Corbin's ass, and they would have given him a golf clap. We had 4,700 votes in our Twitter poll this week, which is a lot. 33% thumbs up, 24% thumbs down, 43% didn't watch. So that's actually a better percentage than normal. That's more thumbs up than thumbs down. So people seem to be more mixed. A lot of people liked Raw this week, and a lot of people did not like Raw. One of the people at the show on Monday, his name is Chris, said that there were two people sitting behind him, yakking away during the show. And one of them asked if they were at WrestleMania because of the giant sign that was hanging up in the rafters. And the other person said, yeah, I think so. I take it we had a lot of casuals in the crowd last Monday. And it hurt the show a lot. But Donovan lives in Lafayette. He was in attendance at the show. He's a fan of the podcast. And he said that he takes offense to all of the people crapping on them for what he thought was a show that, frankly, did not do much to earn a reaction from the crowd. He said that his hometown is not exactly known to be what you would call a smark city. WWE cannot expect them to know who any of the NXT guys are, especially just throwing them out there the way that they did without really explaining who they are or why they should care. He knows who they are, but his argument is that you cannot expect everybody else to. Outside of the NXT guys, he said, we had Baron Corbin against Braun Strowman, the Lucha House Party against Zack Ryder and Curt Hawkins, a team that admits on television every single week what losers they are. What exactly is the crowd supposed to be excited about? Donovan would like to know. Donovan's not wrong in that Raw is a bore and a chore. Raw's bore, Raw's chore. To sit through most weeks, you're right. There is not much to get excited about. But you said people didn't buy tickets to see an NXT show. They bought tickets to see a WWE show. What WWE show exactly were you expecting? Braun Strowman against Baron Corbin is a WWE show. That's what WWE has become. What were you expecting? You know, a WWE show is Strowman and Corbin. It is the Lucha House Party against Hawkins and Ryder. It is Dean Ambrose against Drew McIntyre in a two-minute match. It is Ronda Rousey against Ruby Riott, the same Ruby Riott that she handily defeated in less than 90 seconds the night before at the pay-per-view. You wanted a WWE show, you got one! With a side of NXT. From the moment that Triple H walked out on that show, it was obvious this crowd was comatose. You're right, WWE, they have to do a better job of putting on exciting television. But even on those really bad weeks, I never see a crowd care less than these people did last Monday. Maybe you weren't part of that, but that crowd was an embarrassment. I wish we could have cloned 5,000 Donovans. Instead, we had one Donovan and 4,999 cadavers inside the Cajun Dome on Monday. I mean, look, I love you, brother, but that crowd sucked. The four top names in NXT right now all made their Raw debuts last Monday, and it looks to be more than just a one-shot deal. It's very likely going to be that they are splitting their time between NXT and the main roster, at least through WrestleMania. That's Aleister Black, Ricochet, Johnny Gargano, and Tommaso Ciampa. They had a dazzling debut. Dazzling, I say. Did I mention how dazzling it was? WWE.com sure did. Two separate images posted, one next to the other, one linking to photos from Monday night, the other one to a video. The caption of the first one, Ciampa and Gargano make Raw debut in dazzling tag bout against Dash and Dawson. And then the second one, the caption underneath, reads, the one and only Ricochet teams with Finn Balor in dazzling tag team match. Dazzling! Just dazzling. According to Meltzer, this was, naturally, a late decision. Not even Triple H knew about the NXT call-ups until he was cued in a few days before the show. Many people behind the scenes were said to be caught off guard by the sudden call-ups. You know what the problem was? I'll tell you what the problem was. Vince McMahon got bored of Maroon 5 during the Super Bowl halftime show, and he decided to put on Halftime Heat. Once he saw those four guys, that was it. He said, I want them. And here we are. And in his infinite wisdom, he decided to debut four new faces from NXT in Lafayette, Louisiana. When they have Raw shows coming up tomorrow night in Atlanta, Philadelphia, Chicago, Boston, New York. I mean, it's a freaking, I mean, this is a who's who of cities that you would want to shoot a big angle in, that you would expect to have some of your liveliest crowds and biggest crowds. That is inexcusable. Yes, you always have to assume that there's going to be a segment of the general audience who may not know who these guys are. Not everybody watches NXT. I get that. That's why it's your job to put them in a position to succeed. To look their best the first time out. I said this when I was on with Wade Keller for his SmackDown post show on Tuesday. You only get one chance to make a good first impression. It's no different than a job interview or anything else. You're almost guaranteed to get a reaction in those other cities I just rattled off. Why rush them? Why not hold off 1, 2, 3 weeks? What is the rush? Could they be rushing these guys onto the main roster in advance of a possible NXT move to Fox Sports 1? That's a possibility I've thought about. A lot of people have been thinking about that. We know there's going to be ancillary WWE programming, secondary programming that airs on FS1. They've already confirmed that. We just don't know what that is. And every time somebody, Triple H or somebody, is asked about NXT, is it going to move? He's very coy. He doesn't deny it. He's very coy about the whole thing. I would not at all be surprised if this is the beginning of more of what we're going to see, more NXT call-ups. And being done, because these are the four biggest names. These are not four random NXT names. I think this is being done in advance of an announcement that'll be made in the next few months that NXT is going to either be moving from the network to FS1 or there's going to be a second NXT show that airs on FS1 starting this fall. That's what I think. That's where I think we are headed here. And that is why I think this decision was made. One of many reasons, possibly. But you watch. We're going to get that announcement in the next few months. I have a feeling about that. The best thing I can say about this, at least these guys won all their matches. They didn't beat anybody in, you know, they didn't beat Aleister Black in his debut. They didn't beat Ricochet in his debut. Triple H was out there in the opening segment talking like a babyface. Becky Lynch is suspended for 60 days, but she's not going to let that stop her from getting at Charlotte or Ronda Rousey. And he says, as an executive, I have to say that, you know, you'll be arrested if you try that again. But on a personal note, that was pretty cool. Then he talks about NXT being the future and all the new faces being introduced tonight. And this is after he was just on SmackDown a few weeks ago with Becky, telling her not to listen to us because what we say doesn't matter. There's that bipolar booking again, where one week they're a babyface and the next week we're supposed to boo them. One week Elias is a face, the next week he's a heel. One week Dean Ambrose is a heel, the next week he's a babyface, but no explanation. No wonder people latch on to characters like Kofi Kingston. There's stability there. There's consistency there. People appreciate that. They can get behind somebody like that. They want to see somebody like that succeed. All these other people are goofs. Why should I get behind any of them? Braun Strowman. Speaking of goofs, Braun Strowman got his win back. Good for him. He got his win back over Baron Corbin after losing to him at the Chamber pay-per-view. This time he beat him in a tables match. Back and forth we go. Where this feud goes, nobody knows. Ricochet teamed with Finn Balor to beat Bobby Lashley and Leo Rush. Back together. After Lashley left him laying the night before, after he lost his IC title. The original plan here was Ricochet against Finn Balor. That was what Vince McMahon wanted. Triple H nixed it. He convinced him, let's not do that. He didn't want either man to lose. Balor just won the championship, the IC title, the night before, and Ricochet was making his debut. It's a no-win situation. On his first night in to put that match together? I wonder if they would be willing to go with Ricochet and Balor for WrestleMania for the Intercontinental title. I'd be down for that. That's a match I could get behind. But thank God Triple H got his way. Can you imagine burning that match on Ricochet's debut with no promotion or anything like that? Just kind of throw it out there? Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa, they beat The Revival in a non-title match. I thought this was good, even you know, for an empty arena match. But this was, again, a no-win situation. You either beat the new guys on their first night in, or the new guys beat your tag team champions a week after they won the belts. Which is exactly what happened here. Gargano and Ciampa, they played babyface here. At least if you watched, if you really paid attention to Johnny's body language, especially when the match was over, I feel like he at least tried to play it up like he wasn't totally comfortable being partners with Ciampa, which he shouldn't be. By the next night, though, on SmackDown, that was all gone. It was like the last year never even happened. It was just babyface DIY, back together again. NXT storylines be damned. Aleister Black, he made his debut. He beat Elias. I thought this was pretty boring, but at least he won. Charlie Caruso, she did an interview with Heavy Machinery on the stage. They got in their stakes and weights catchphrase when all of a sudden Lacey Evans randomly walked down the ramp and then back up the ramp. Meanwhile, you've got Otis and Tucker. They see this. They're going to mimic her. They start marching up and down the ramp like a couple of fat bushwhackers, flailing their arms around back and forth. How has this show never won an Emmy? I can't imagine. Give them an Emmy. Give Kevin Dunn his Emmy Award. The week before, Dean Ambrose pinned EC3 with a roll-up to get his win back after EC3 rolled him up the week before that. And now here, Ambrose lost clean to Drew McIntyre in 2 minutes with the Claymore kick. Tell me again how this helps EC3. Tell me again. Oh, that's right. It doesn't. That's right. Foolish of me. He wasn't even on the show this week. Now imagine for a moment. Let me paint a picture for you. Everybody has their ideas of how things should be done. Let me propose something to you. Picture it. They have EC3 come out on television, like I pitched last month, when John Cena came back and he confronted John Cena. He throws his name in the hat to enter the Royal Rumble match. And imagine if they shot an angle, maybe not at the Rumble, maybe on Raw the next night. Maybe Cena eliminates EC3 from the Royal Rumble match, and the next night they shoot this big injury angle to take Cena out so he can go film his movie. And for weeks leading up to WrestleMania, EC3 in his $10,000 suit and his $5,000 shirt goes around talking about how I took John Cena out of WrestleMania. Only for Cena to make his triumphant return, sets up a match between the two at WrestleMania with John Cena versus EC3 and EC3 going over. Cena rides off for a while. EC3 is a made man. He just beat John Cena, one of the biggest stars in the company, at WrestleMania. No place for him on Raw after that? That's fine. There's a shakeup coming up in April. That is how you make a new... And by the way, he's probably better off being on SmackDown anyway. I would shake his ass up right onto the SmackDown roster is what I would do. But there you go. That is how you make a new star. Not whatever the fuck it is they're doing with him now. The moment that Lars Sullivan went AWOL on them, they could have slotted EC3 into that position. Right now, Cena doesn't even have a match at WrestleMania. He may not even wrestle at WrestleMania. Good job. Ronda Rousey beat Ruby Riott for the second time in two nights, although this time it took her 10 minutes as opposed to 90 seconds. I guess Ruby figured out her secret. Originally, it was going to be Ronda winning a quick squash over Alexa Bliss, but they had more time to fill than they thought they would need, so instead they went with a rematch from the pay-per-view. Whatever. Shit happens. At least Ruby had the chance to get offense in this time. I thought they did her dirty at the pay-per-view. And so I will say that it was nice at least for her to be competitive the next night. The outcome was never in doubt, but at least she was able to be competitive on television. And as I look back on the show, Donovan, I gotta say, man, on second thought, never mind. SmackDown Live was from Nollins, New Orleans, Louisiana, one of my favorite places that I've ever been to. Over 2,500 votes, 55 up, only 4% thumbs down. 41% said they didn't watch. That is a tremendous score for SmackDown. And a better night for the new NXT faces than Raw last Monday, I would say. We had Andrade Cien Almas against Aleister Black. Zelina Vega was out there rooting against her new husband. She and Aleister just got married. I even saw that Dave Hero officiated the ceremony. Dave Hero of PWR fame, Pro Wrestling Report. I also see that it looks like Andrade and Charlotte are apparently a thing. It's hard to keep up with all these WWE couples, but apparently now that is a thing. I saw Sean Ross Sapp said they've been a thing since at least last month, an item, whatever. I know Charlotte and Del Rio were together, at least briefly, at one point, before he started dating Paige. And now she's with Andrade. It looks like she might have a type. But, so let's see if we can figure this out here. We've got Black and Vega, right? We've got Charlotte and Andrade, possibly. We've got Corey and Carmella. We've got Murphy and Bliss. Ambrose and Renee. Rusev and Lana. Miz and Maryse. And Brian and Brie. I don't count the other ones who were together before they came to WWE, like Candice and Gargano and all that. I don't count that. Man, WWE ought to start its own matchmaking service. They can make some money that way. Actually, you know how we sometimes we'll hear them talk about how, oh, WWE, it's like one big family, right? It's like, we're one big family. Actually, I forgot one. Trinity and Uso, Jimmy Uso, that's another one. But, you know, we hear them talk about how WWE, man, it's like one big family. We're like one big family. That's a lot of inbreeding going on in that family. Actually, Paige responded to a news website that put a photo up of her leaving. This was leaving like a studio or a theater or something, probably for her movie, in New York. And she had a guy with her. And I don't know what website it was, what news website, quote unquote news. But they identified the man with her as her boyfriend. And she had to correct them because it turns out it was her brother. Oops. Anyway, these two had a good match. Black Mask kick for the win by Aleister. Hated that it was Almas who had to take the loss here, but I can't hate on a match that was good like that. So, good night for him. DIY beat the bar when Tommaso Ciampa rolled up Cesaro. Ciampa and Gargano were total baby faces here on this show. Totally cool with one another, which I hated. You know, at least, like I said, on Monday, you can sense some hesitation on the part of Gargano. And here, it was like the last year and a half just never happened. I also question the wisdom of having Sheamus and Cesaro openly laughing and mocking the new guys before the match, given that those two new guys just so happened to hold the top two titles in all of NXT. These weren't just like any two NXT stars. This was your North American champion at the time, and your NXT champion. And they're laughing at them, and I know why they did it, because they wanted to show that Sheamus and Cesaro weren't taking them seriously, and so that when they lost to them, it would mean something, it would mean more. Any other two people, I would have been fine with it. It just, with these two, it just rubbed me the wrong way. But there was a very scary spot during this match where Ciampa went for a somersault powerbomb off the top, out of the corner on Sheamus. And there was a nasty landing where Sheamus came straight down on top of Ciampa's leg. It looked like he mangled his leg on the way down. Sheamus looked like he got hurt too, like his back maybe got hurt. But I thought for sure Ciampa tore his knee out. This was the other knee. This was the healthy knee, not the one that has a brace on it that he had operated on. Miraculously, unless he's hiding something, he seems to be fine. He is the luckiest man alive after watching that, because I was convinced that we were getting the announcement the next day that this guy was taking another 6 to 9 month vacation. So he's very fortunate that that's not the case. Johnny Gargano will wrestle Cesaro this Tuesday on SmackDown. Also, Ricochet is teaming with Aleister Black to take on the team of... And by the way, Aleister Black, over under, what do you guys think on how long it takes for him to just become Aleister? I give it 3 weeks, max. But it'll be Aleister Black and Ricochet taking on Rusev and Shinsuke Nakamura. So that's already set for SmackDown on Tuesday. We had The Miz and Shane McMahon. They are getting a rematch with The Usos at Fastlane for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. And it is in The Miz's hometown of Cleveland. The best part about all of this is that Miz told Shane that his father is going to be ringside for their match at the pay-per-view. It's happening. It's really going to happen. I'm very excited about this. I want Mr. Miz to give Shane a low blow and align with his son as an evil heel duo for The Miz's match with Shane at WrestleMania. That's what I would like to see. But then I remember, I say, where are they for the pay-per-view? They're in Cleveland. That's The Miz's hometown. That's George Mizanin's hometown, probably, I guess. We all know what that usually means when you're in your hometown. So I wonder, would they have The Miz's dad turn on his son instead? Would they swerve us by having him turn on Miz instead? Because after all, look, it was The Miz who got pinned at the Elimination Chamber. He's the one who lost the tag team titles. It wasn't Shane. Shane was outside the ring. It was actually The Miz who lost those titles. You know, and look, don't get me wrong. It would be fucking great for George Mizanin to go on TV and cut a promo, you know, or however, whatever kind of promo he can cut on TV the Tuesday after the show, disowning his son for losing the tag team titles at the pay-per-view. You know, look, Miz is having another baby, him and Maurice. So what? Who cares? You lost the titles. That's what George could say. Then he could say that Shane is my new son now. I'm disowning you, and Shane is my new son. As entertaining as I think that could be, I still think Miz has to be the heel. It just feels wrong for him to be in the babyface role. I'm shocked that he gets the reactions he does. I'm not even saying people don't cheer for him. They do. I'm stunned. But there are people, he gets a good reaction when he comes out now as a babyface. I just don't see that as a long-term thing here. I think he should be a heel. I think his father should be a heel, and I think they should be together. In a week where Eric Young and Asuka were both released by their kidnapper, by their captors, EY on this show lost to Ricochet. Easy win for Ricochet. We are still missing our United States champion. R-Truth has been MIA since he won that title. Which begs the question, why did they even put the title on him in the first place if they had no plans for him? Why ask why? I have not read anything about him having some kind of injury or being hurt. More likely, it's just a case of, you know, we have nothing for him. We're heading into WrestleMania. He's not one of our featured performers. Yeah, he's only the U.S. champion, but he's not one of our featured performers, and so we don't really have anything for him. Kind of reminds me of when he was cut by WWE the first time. This was years ago. This was before he even went to TNA. When it was still NWA TNA and he won the NWA World Heavyweight title. Yeah, this is, he got cut by WWE and he said at the time that they let him go without any explanation other than just to say to him, these things happen. That's the reason he was given. These things happen. And then when Truth tried to call Vince McMahon on the phone, couldn't get him, tried to call Jim Ross on the phone, couldn't get him, just to find out why. Neither one would return his phone calls. Come on here. Show some respect, finally, for your U.S. champion. This disrespect for R-Truth, it's disgusting. You know, if they were just going to put the title on Ice, I don't know why they didn't just go with my idea, which was to put the title on Andrade. Built to a title match at WrestleMania with him and Rey Mysterio. Mask versus title. What's Rey going to do? We haven't seen Rey on TV in weeks either. I don't know why they didn't just transition that belt onto Almas and build to one last big match with him and Rey with that stipulation at WrestleMania. That WrestleMania card needs all the help it can get right now. At least that would have been something of an attraction. You look at what they've done with it instead. I know I shouldn't be, but I am just flabbergasted by this. It's unbelievable. Mandy Rose pinned Asuka with a roll-up after Lacey Evans walked out and distracted Asuka. That and Mandy was faking an eye injury from a knee from Asuka when she scored the roll-up. Asuka tapped out Becky Lynch at the Royal Rumble, and now she's losing by roll-up on TV to Mandy Rose? And I like Mandy. I think she's improving every time I see her. But Asuka should not be getting rolled up on television like everybody else. You can't tell me that they can't find another way to get Mandy into the spot as number one contender. They had to do this. She's going to get a shot at Fastlane. I have to assume that's where this is headed. That or a triple threat, maybe. They'll even throw in Sonya. It could be Sonya, Mandy, again, and Asuka for the championship. I could see that, too. Mandy and Sonya were impressive last weekend in the Elimination Chamber. But the way they did this, this was just stupid. This is just lazy, dumb, stupid booking. Main event, we had AJ Styles, Jeff Hardy, and Kofi Kingston against Daniel Bryan, Randy Orton, and Samoa Joe. And it was Kofi who pinned the champion. He pinned Bryan with the Trouble in Paradise. And one of the funny... And I did not see this at first. I actually did not realize this until people started posting the GIFs on Twitter. That during the match, when Kofi was in there with Orton, he knocked Orton down. And he started yelling, "Stupid, stupid, stupid," at Randy Orton in something of a throwback to one... He botched an RKO attempt 10 years ago, it's been, and Orton did the same thing to him. And that really was the night that people point to as the end of Kofi's push. Whatever push he was getting at the time officially died on that night. So Kofi got to return the favor here to Randy Orton. Although I don't think if I'm Orton, I'm too worried about my push. But Kofi pinned the champion here. Shane came out and announced that it's going to be Kofi Kingston challenging Daniel Bryan for the WWE Championship at Fastlane. I don't know what the original plan was. Supposedly Vince McMahon changed it, whatever it was, after he saw the reaction to Kofi that he got at the Chamber and he got online. And I think if they can figure out a way out of a clean finish at Fastlane, they could build to one more match between them at WrestleMania. But I got to be honest with you. I don't see them taking the championship off Daniel Bryan even at WrestleMania. Forget Fastlane. He's not losing it at Fastlane. I don't see them taking the championship off him even at WrestleMania, whoever he faces. I think Seth Rollins and Becky Lynch are locked in for big wins on that show. The big emotional wins at WrestleMania, I think, are already earmarked for those two. I think Seth slays the Beast. He's the one now, you know, take the title again from Brock Lesnar after Roman did it at SummerSlam. Brock got it back. He's held the title hostage for so long. And Seth's going to be the one to get his crowning moment and take the Universal title back for Monday Night Raw. And I think Becky Lynch, everything has been building for months for her to get that win over Ronda Rousey and, you know, walk out of WrestleMania, end WrestleMania as the new champion, as the new Raw Women's Champion. And because I think that's where the company's focus is right now as far as those big emotional wins, title wins, I don't know that they would want to have another one on the show with Kofi. I feel like in their mind it could be overkill. And it could be Kofi, it could be anybody, it could be Mustafa Ali, it could be anybody else. I would feel the same way. I don't see them pulling the trigger on three big title changes. All three on the same show. You know, it would still be a cool story, I think, for Kofi to go all the way to WrestleMania when, in his 11 years in the company, he has never, not one time, if you can believe it, had a singles match at a WrestleMania. He's been in Battle Royals, he's been in six-man tags and Money in the Bank matches and ladder matches, but he's never had a singles match, a one-on-one match at WrestleMania. For his first one to be for the WWE Championship would be pretty cool. But that said, I maintain what I said 2 weeks ago, which is that Kevin Owens is the likeliest person to face Bryan for the title of WrestleMania. I think they're doing it at Fastlane. Kofi will get a shot. He'll lose, or at least he won't win the championship. I guess they could always leave open the possibility of him getting screwed and coming back, you know, a month or two from that show and saying, hey, I never lost, and they could do something with Kofi at that point, I guess. But I don't see him winning the championship at Fastlane, and I think Kevin Owens is going to be the man going to WrestleMania. He is being portrayed in these vignettes as the everyman now. He's stuffing his face with popcorn and pizza every week. The antithesis of everything that Daniel Bryan now represents in terms of consumption and, you know, and just overindulging. And Kevin Owens is the complete and polar opposite of Daniel Bryan in the way he is portrayed on TV. They go together like oil and water. And it looks like Owens is coming back as a babyface. Time-wise, it would make sense. He said a few weeks ago, it's going to be about a month before I'm able to come back, and that would put him back right around the time the Fastlane happens. So he's still, to me, the most obvious choice, and I think the man who goes to Mania to wrestle for the championship, and he too, I don't think is going to win. I think Bryan is leaving WrestleMania with the title. I think they're going to want at least one of their big champions to escape with the title, and I think it's going to be him. Second sad tweet this week, or tweets, come from the co-executive producer of Lucha Underground, former WWE writer Chris DeJoseph, who was asked by a fan about the future of Lucha Underground, which I have been very curious to find out about. And the answer he gave is what I had feared for a while now. He said, personally, I think it's dead, but I hope not. And in a follow-up tweet, he said, well, at this point, it's on the producers. If you want it, demand it. I'm no fan of how some of the talent is being treated, the way that they are essentially being held hostage right now by their contracts, and a lot of them want out. Some of them have filed suit against the company and you know, the executives in charge to try to break free from their contracts because they can't go anywhere. Right? So I think that whole situation is completely fucked. I think it's terrible. And there's been no update. There's been no word given even to the talent, let alone you and me, about the status and the future of the show. How can you do that? How can you tell somebody you're not allowed to leave? You're not allowed to go work somewhere else. We'll pay you a very basic wage. I don't get the sense Ivelisse and Joey Ryan are getting paid a shitload of money to sit at home and do nothing. And at a time when wrestling is booming, at least in terms of all these different promotions and money is being thrown around, and they can't do anything. How can you not feel bad for these people and want them to be able to break free and leave? Despite that, that is not DeJoseph's fault. These are decisions that are being made by those higher up the food chain there than him. It's probably a AAA thing. AAA is involved in this as well, you know, with Lucha Underground. And that being said, I'm a big fan of the show, and I think it deserves closure. I would love to see either one final season or one final big episode to tie up loose ends and wrap everything up. I know a lot of TV shows, they get canceled. They don't get that chance. They don't get a chance to wrap everything up in a nice big bow. But it would be nice if Lucha Underground did. So to hear from the executive producer of the show that in his opinion, he thinks the whole thing is dead, yeah, that doesn't inspire a lot of confidence as far as there being a fifth season. And I'm sure that doesn't make all those people who are locked into their contracts sitting at home feel good either. I became a fan of Pentagon Jr. and Phoenix through this show. Dario Cueto, one of the greatest characters on any wrestling show in the last 20 years. Easily one of the best authority figures. At a time when I am sick to death of authority figures. I never got bored of Dario Cueto. I looked forward to his segments on that show. The women of Lucha Underground, you know, and how they were positioned as strong characters. The emphasis on intergender matches, which I admit I'm not a big fan of. Not the one-on-ones. I mean, the tag matches were fine, but the constant one-on-one when they would do male versus female, I never could just get into it. But when WWE started crowing about its women's revolution, I laughed. I laughed because what I was seeing on Lucha Underground, what they were doing on Lucha Underground with the women on their show made what WWE was doing at the time look like child's play. So they made what WWE was doing look like an episode of Peppa Pig. Yeah, you got Famous B, 423 Get Fame. What's not to like about Famous B? Or the way that he would say Tejano's name. The way the show was filmed, the way the show was shot, the vignettes, you either loved it or you hated it. I loved it. It was different. It was gritty. It wasn't WWE. Maybe that's what I liked most of all about it. It felt like something so totally different than what I get on Raw and SmackDown every week that I learned to love it and I learned to appreciate it. Finally, something different, not just people saying, oh, we're going to be different, and then they put on basically WWE Lite. That's not what Lucha Underground was. It was it never, ever felt like that. It never felt like a light version, a diet version of WWE. Because I get enough of that during the week. I get more than my fix of WWE. I want something different. 5 hours worth of WWE, in fact. Six, if you count NXT. This was different. This was wrestling done in a way that I hadn't seen before. And if this really is the end, then you know what? That sucks. That's too bad because, you know, a lot of people were invested in that show. They did stick it out for the first four seasons. Not everybody did. Some people gave up on it after the first one or two. But it also gave a boost to a lot of people who are out there right now making money working for other promotions like Impact, like MLW and AEW. It gave them a platform. That's the legacy, I think, of this show. That and murder. Lots and lots of murder. Violent murder, too. Gory, bloody, violent murder. I will miss that. NXT, the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic, is coming back. Eight teams, with the winner receiving a shot at the War Raiders and the NXT Tag Team titles at TakeOver New York on April 5th. Last year, Undisputed Era won the tournament. 2017, I don't think there was one. Authors of Pain and Finn Balor and Samoa Joe were the first two winners of the Dusty Classic. The teams announced so far include Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish of the Undisputed Era. The Forgotten Sons, oh God, Fabian Aichner and Marcel Bartel, and the Street Profits. And the other four teams were announced at the tapings this week, so this is a spoiler warning for those who do not want to know who these other four teams are. If you are that sensitive to spoilers, if you are allergic to them, I would say skip ahead by about 2 minutes or so. You have been warned. The other four teams are Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch, Tyler Bate and Trent Seven, Ricochet and Aleister Black, and the reunited DIY. Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa. Very curious to see how they play that angle out on TV. There is a segment with them that explains why they would be together. So, at least on NXT, unlike the main roster this week, they're going to attempt to explain why these two would want to team up together. So, the first round matches start airing in 2 weeks. I don't know the full brackets because I did not read any of the match results. I didn't read the full spoilers on what happened. But I cannot see them not having an NXT title match on that TakeOver show or having the champion wrestle for the tag team titles and then come back out and wrestle again for the, you know, the main title on a show that's probably going to have five matches anyway, maybe six, but usually they have five. So that would mean that Ciampa and Gargano have to lose. And given that Gargano lost the North American title to the Velveteen Dream this week, him challenging Ciampa for the NXT championship, going back to being a babyface and challenging for the NXT title in Brooklyn, would seem to be the outcome here. This seems to be what they've been building towards now for the better part of a year and a half. You know, I know they were out there like bosom buddies on TV this week, but they have to pay off this storyline. They can't just drop it. This has been going on now for over a year. Gargano has to get his revenge on Ciampa and win the one title that has eluded him his entire time in NXT. That has to be the payoff to this entire thing. The Matt Riddle interview that aired on TV this week, I already talked about that when I was talking about the Bruce Pritchard stuff, so if you want my thoughts on that, you can go back to that segment if you skipped it. And in Johnny Gargano's first title defense of the North American Championship on TV. He lost to the Velveteen Dream in a great match. Turned into a festival of near falls at the end. Gargano connected with his slingshot DDT for a near fall, or as Jim Ross once called it, a damn near fall. You want a tough trivia question? I'll give you a trivia question. What match am I referring to where Jim Ross used that term, a damn near fall? Now I'm going to have people come at me with like 15 examples and I'm going to feel like an idiot. But that was the only time I ever remember hearing him say it like that. It's one match, one particular match. There was a very close near fall. He called it a near fall and then he said a damn near fall. I want you to tell me what match that was. The only hint I'm going to give you, I have to give a hint. A guy called matches for 30 some odd years. I should give you a hint. Only hint that you get is it was a WWE match from 1999. That's the only, I don't even know why I remember this, but I do. I want to see if anybody gets that. Dream hit not one, but two Death Valley drivers, climbed up top, hit the purple Rainmaker elbow for the win. Full Sail came unglued. They showed Tommaso Ciampa up, watching in the catbird seat up at the height of Full Sail, looking down up in the rafters somewhere watching this. He looked disappointed in Johnny. Velveteen Dream gets his first taste of gold in WWE, and very likely not his last. He should consider himself lucky to have not been part of those four NXT call-ups this week. It'll mean more when the time is right and he gets called up on his own. If I were him, I know he's crowing every week on social media. Pick me, Vince. Don't forget about me. Call me up. Call me up. Be careful what you wish for. I think he's much better off being where he is right now. Give him a nice run with the North American title. You know, 6 months from now, maybe it'll be his time. If I were him, judging by how they've handled a lot of these new NXT call-ups, I would be in no rush. One last sad tweet. This one has absolutely nothing to do with wrestling, and it's sad only if you take it as someone literally felt this way and not just a joke, which I'm sure it was, but this has nothing to do with wrestling, and it is kind of morbid, but I laughed very hard. I haven't laughed this hard in a while when I saw this. It's from a lady named Juliet, at Juliet Moore underscore on Twitter, who claims to have found the greatest YouTube comment of all time. From somebody who wrote, "When I was younger, I thought JonBenet Ramsey was Gordon Ramsay's daughter, and the reason he was so angry all the time was because his daughter was dead." I have a sixth sense of humor, what can I say? Some of the comments underneath are pretty good too. It's like, Gordon was told that the only clue was that the killer worked at a failing restaurant, and he travels the world now publicly to save the restaurants, but privately to get justice. Now it all makes sense. Now imagine if somebody actually posted that not as a gag and they actually believe that. Let's get to your mailbag questions. If you have them, you could always email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. When you write in, we'll start here with Tyler from Philadelphia. With the recent push of Kofi Kingston into the WWE Championship picture in place of an injured Mustafa Ali, what do you think of having Mustafa Ali help Daniel Bryan beat Kofi at Fastlane? Then on SmackDown, Mustafa attacks both Bryan and Kofi, expressing that he only helped Bryan to retain the title because he wants to be the one to beat him for it at WrestleMania, not Kofi, who, quote, lucked into his spot. This sets up a triple threat match between Daniel Bryan, Kofi Kingston, and Mustafa Ali at WrestleMania for the title. And who would win that match? That's what Tyler wants to know. I don't like that idea, because that makes Mustafa Ali a heel. The whole point of including him in the title match at WrestleMania, if he was included, would be to give the fans an underdog that they can root for. People don't want to root against Mustafa Ali. When they post those videos online of him with his daughter, they post those promos of him talking about paying his dues and climbing his way up. They don't want to boo this guy. You don't want to give them a reason for half the crowd who loves Kofi to think that this guy sucks and to boo him whenever he comes out. It would be the same thing with Kofi. He would be the underdog. If it's him at WrestleMania, he would be in the underdog spot, just like Mustafa would be. To turn him heel and to muddy the waters so that the guy gets no reaction at all, I think would be a waste of a good story. And if you do that triple threat match, you ask me who wins, I'll tell you who wins. Daniel Bryan wins. That's who wins. If they turn that... Look, I think Bryan's winning either way. But if they turn this into a triple threat match, Bryan easily retains the title. Easily. Because he could beat Mustafa without ever having to beat Kofi. That would piss a lot of people off if he beat Kofi straight up. I mean, in a triple threat situation like that, there's no need for them to even think about switching the title. Like I said earlier, they're already going to have Seth Rollins beat Brock Lesnar, most likely. Let me clarify that and say most likely. I can't say for sure. Last year, right? We all knew that Roman Reigns was going to be the new Universal Champion. He was going to beat Brock Lesnar, right? Until he didn't. So, and that's a decision that still baffles me. But Rollins is probably going to win the Universal title of WrestleMania. Becky Lynch is probably going to win the Raw Women's title of WrestleMania. My spidey senses tell me that Daniel Bryan retains. Although, if it ends up one-on-one against Kofi, well, again, there's going to be a lot of really upset people, but I just can't see Bryan losing at WrestleMania. I just can't. I really think he's going to retain either way. Zach from West Virginia. I'm not sure what direction Ciampa and Gargano were headed on the main roster, but if Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn return soon enough, how would you feel about a feud between the two teams, possibly even culminating with a match at WrestleMania? Well, that's too soon for WrestleMania. I think Owens and Zayn against DIY would be excellent, but WrestleMania is not happening. I still think Owens faces Bryan for the championship of WrestleMania. I think Zayn is not going to be back in time for WrestleMania. I could see him coming back the night after, maybe, on Monday Night Raw, but not WrestleMania. I still feel this way. I think that there is a need for Owens and Zayn to be separated for a while. They've been like Siamese twins ever since they've been called up from NXT. They've never left each other's side. They've always been on the same roster together. We've seen countless matches between them. Then they became tag team partners, so we've seen them do both. It's time that they get moved to different brands. You know, when they do that shakeup in April, they could put Zayn, let's say, on Raw and Owens on SmackDown. Or vice versa, whichever order they want it to be in. They've been together ever since they were called up. I think it's time to keep them apart for a little while. Because if they're on the same roster, you could say, well, you could keep them apart, but keep them on the same roster in case you want to do something with them. It would be awfully tempting for Vince McMahon to just put the two of them back together. They need to be on separate rosters. If there's going to be a brand split, they should be on separate brands. Daniel from Ohio, I finished watching the Elimination Chamber, and I'm curious what the plans are for Braun Strowman at WrestleMania. I'm writing this before Raw, so maybe we will get some more clarity. He's talking about Raw from last week. But I think I know how this might play out. I'm thinking that this could turn into a six-man tag team match where Braun has to find some partners. Obviously, they have to find a way to get through Fastlane first, but I'm sure they could do another singles match between Braun and one of the three heels. So who would Braun be partnered with? How about Braun's old buddies from the Wyatt family, Bray Wyatt and Luke Harper? This does not need to be any kind of Wyatt family reunion, just a way for each of them to return with a high-profile match at WrestleMania. Well, they had Braun beat Corbin on Raw last Monday. I'd love for this to be over, but I fear that it's not. I think you may be onto something here. You know, right now, Lashley and McIntyre, unless they put McIntyre in there with John Cena, they have no obvious roles for WrestleMania. You know they're going to be on the card, and guess what? Braun Strowman doesn't either. You got to do something with them. This feels like it's building to something, some kind of blow-off. Kurt Angle, if he does wrestle, it sounds like he might be doing a retirement match against somebody, so let's say he's off the table as a possible partner. So Braun having to go out and find partners does make sense. Bray is either ready or about ready to make a comeback in the ring. Same with Luke Harper. If they don't add Harper to the act with Rowan and Daniel Bryan on SmackDown, then why not? Why not reunite the two of them on the other brand and have them help Braun Strowman? Chris, from London, England, with D-Generation X's Hall of Fame induction announced, what was your personal favorite DX moment? Also, how did you feel about DX's very short reunion in 2002, which led to the Triple H-HBK feud from 02 to 04? My favorite DX moment? Probably the Mike Tyson tease, or the Mike Tyson reveal that they did on Raw before WrestleMania 14. It was such a hot moment, man. It really was. When everybody thought Tyson and Michaels were about to have a match, they're going to have a fist fight on Raw. Michaels is rearing back, and he yanks the Attitude Era shirt, or the Attitude Era, the Attitude shirt, off of Tyson to reveal a DX shirt. And you got Vince McMahon and his cronies at ringside. He's furious about this. You know, he marches off. It was a great swerve, you know, given where they were going at WrestleMania. But I just thought that at that moment, it just had such a big time feel to it. You know, it felt like a really big deal. Michaels telling him, you know, at first, you get your people out of here. I'll get my people out of here. He called him boy and like really getting him hyped up. Everybody leaves the ring. Michaels goes to his corner. Tyson goes to his. Place is going nuts. You know, we don't get moments like that very often on Raw anymore, unfortunately. Now, I like the mock WCW invasion also. That was fun, you know, when they kind of marched to Atlanta and they were walking around CNN Center and they tried to get into the arena. They did a whole bunch of different skits led by Bruce Pritchard, actually. Pritchard was the agent in charge of leading the charge there for all that stuff. It's funny, after talking about Pritchard earlier on the show here this week. But, you know, as far as I wasn't really a fan of the reunions that they did, the reunion in 2006 when Triple H went babyface, I'm sure they made a lot of money on the glow sticks and other merch. And I will say, I did laugh when they were screwing around with Vince McMahon's microphone that one time. And they made his voice sound all high-pitched on the microphone. That might be the only DX moment that I really laughed a lot at when they did that. But a lot of the stuff they did in those later years, I just thought was lame. It was just a lame PG version of DX that was meant to pop little kids, which is fine. It's just not for me. Brogan from Nova Scotia, Canada. What did you think of Dolph Ziggler's 2018 run with Drew McIntyre? I personally thought it was the best work of his career. The matches Dolph and Seth Rollins had were always must-see. What did you think? I mean, in ring, it may have been some of the best work that he's done, you know, and he was featured in a top program on Raw. But Raw sucked for most of last year. You know, I mean, they had no champion. When you have an absentee champion, you've got to find other ways to make things interesting, which is why Dolph and Drew got so much time together and why the Intercontinental title got so much time in main events. Only reason was because Brock Lesnar wasn't around or somebody else didn't have that Universal title. So he benefited from that. I don't know. I would stop short, though, I think, of calling it the best work of his career. It was probably up there, but yeah, my favorite Dolph Ziggler period. And it didn't last as long as probably his run with Drew last year. It was only a few months. But I would say my favorite Dolph Ziggler period was probably after he won the Money in the Bank briefcase in 2012. Actually, it was longer than a few months. I think he feuded with Chris Jericho over the briefcase. I remember that. And then he had that ladder match with John Cena at the TLC pay-per-view, which he won. That was when AJ tipped the ladder over. And we had this little faction, this little unit of Dolph, Big E, who had just debuted, and AJ Lee. You know, this is back before Vince McMahon stole Big E's last name. He was still Big E Langston when he debuted on the main roster. And then, of course, the cash-in on Raw the night after WrestleMania 29. One of the greatest live moments of any show that I've ever been to. Still to this day. The building rumbled when he came out and he beat Del Rio that night. Rumbled. The second greatest Money in the Bank cash-in, in fact, of all time. Behind Seth Rollins was the Dolph Ziggler cash-in in 2013. So that whole period, when he won the briefcase to when he cashed in, and he had that little partnership going with AJ and Big E, if I had to pick one period of Ziggler's career that I think I enjoyed the most, I'd probably go with that one. Sean from Waterford, Connecticut. Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels are my two favorites, but their Iron Man match often gets labeled overrated. You might be listening to my show. I've used that word before myself. I think it's the stipulation as opposed to the match quality. Time limits in wrestling kill the suspense. Would it have been better for them to do a 2 out of 3 falls match instead of an Iron Man match at WrestleMania 12? They could have had Bret beat Shawn to win the first fall. Shawn beat Bret to win the second and third falls. What say you? I think the Iron Man stipulation absolutely hurt the match because they told people ahead of time that the first three quarters of the match really didn't matter. You know, so people sat on their hands for a good part of it. The fact that neither man scored a single fall until the finish, that only made things worse. You know, one of the things I actually enjoyed about the Triple H Rock Iron Man match, which I liked better than the WrestleMania 12 one, I thought was a better match. Besides the fact that that finish, my God, I mean, that crowd went so ballistic and big Undertaker debut as American Badass and all that. But they kept the match interesting by having a whole bunch of falls. It wasn't 0-0. It wasn't 1-1 or 2-1. I think the final score in that match was 6-5. They kept it interesting, you know? So that, I think, is part of why I just enjoyed that match a lot more. So you've got this Iron Man stip. Everybody knows the match is not going to really end or build to any kind of suspense until 50, 55 minutes in. Or maybe 45, 50 minutes in. And on top of that, no one's scoring a fall. 0-0. You know, it's tied up the entire time. That's not exciting. You know, that's not fun. So, you know, I think that the idea of a 2 out of 3 falls match with Brett, let's say, winning the first fall after the first 15 minutes go by, and Sean winning the second fall after another 15 minutes, now they're all tied up. It comes down to the next fall, sudden death, basically. Next person to score a pin or submission wins the championship. You could let them go another 20, 30 minutes, you know, to get to that 1 hour mark. You could still have a 1 hour match. But just by making those little tweaks to the rules, I think people would have been a little more into it than it felt like they were. Have a bunch of near falls, keep the match exciting, keep the people engaged. I think in hindsight, that would have made the match better. I agree. It would have made, for, put it this way, it would have made for a more exciting 60-minute match. And we'll end here with Jeff in Baltimore. Buy or sell on the feud that could have happened but never did. Hulk Hogan and Evil Doink in 1993 or Triple H and Brock Lesnar in 2002? You know, Hulk Hogan versus Evil Doink the Clown in 1993 is the feud I never knew I wanted, but now I'm sad that we didn't get it. I'm buying on Hogan and Doink. I'm going to sell on Triple H and Lesnar. I wasn't a fan of their feud in 2012. I don't know that I would have been much more of a fan of Triple H and Lesnar in 02. I don't think I needed it 10 years earlier either. Heel Doink torturing all of the little Hulkamaniacs. Oh man, I think that could have been amazing. Heel Doink torturing all the little Hulkamaniacs at ringside, that would have been great. Have segments maybe where he invites a new kid each week, like up onto the interview platform, like DiBiase used to do when he would invite kids and people out of the crowd to, you know, get money. And you could, you know, like when DiBiase, he would invite them over and screw them over and be like, well, the lesson you just learned is that life's not fair. See, DiBiase was teaching life lessons at a very early age to all of us young wrestling fans. But you could have Doink up there making them animal balloons and then popping them and making them cry. Oh, that would have been so great. But they could have gotten real sinister if they wanted to. That was still a very cartoon-y period for WWE. They were very cartoony with a lot of things they were doing. I don't know how dark they would have gotten in 1993 on WWE television, but if they wanted to, they certainly could have. Look, if Hogan were around full-time, which he was not, he came back, he was only around for a few months, and then he left. If Hogan were around full-time and didn't leave so quick, I think Hogan and Doink could have had a program like Hogan and Bossman. You know, Hogan and Bossman never headlined a major pay-per-view. They never headlined a SummerSlam or a WrestleMania or anything like that. They had a big cage match on Saturday night's main event. They got some mileage out of that program. They took it around on all the house show loops and everything. But, you know, there's been a story out there for years. And I think it actually originated with Matt Bourne, who played Doink, and he probably wasn't the most credible source. But he claimed that it was originally supposed to be Doink against Hogan, not Crush, at WrestleMania 9. But Hogan didn't want to work with him. And so the whole thing got nixed. If it is true, and Hogan nixed it because he didn't want to work with him, look, I don't blame him. You put yourself in Hulk Hogan's shoes at the time, brother. You've been out of the company for a year. You're primed to make this big comeback heading into the biggest show of the year, right? WrestleMania. And the plan is for you to wrestle this new guy in a clown costume? Who hasn't even really been established yet. You gotta remember, Doink spent the first 6 weeks on television, when he quote-unquote debuted, watching matches from the crowd. He was walking through the crowd making balloon animals for kids. Jumping up and down. I wouldn't blame Hogan in this instance if he said no. I'm not feeling it, brother. I wouldn't either. That's a match I think they would have been better off doing later in 93, not at WrestleMania, but I don't believe that match was ever planned anyway. I think Bourne is full of it. Either that or he got fed a bunch of lies, which is very possible. Maybe Vince or Pat Patterson or somebody told him that they had an idea, you know, to do something with him and Hogan at WrestleMania. It's like Bret Hart. Bret Hart is convinced, I think, or was, that, you know, he was going to wrestle the Ultimate Warrior at the Royal Rumble in 93, not Razor Ramon. If Warrior didn't get fired, they were building to him and the Warrior at the Rumble or WrestleMania, and he was going to win. Do you honestly believe that WWE would have had the Ultimate Warrior put over Bret Hart? Or here's the better question, that the Warrior would have actually got along with that? The Warrior would have had such a belly laugh, we would have heard it all the way from here. Where do you live at the time? Arizona, he was living? I could have heard him belly laugh all the way from New York. He probably would have quit the company on the spot just for that. But I don't doubt that maybe somebody said to Bret, hey, look, we want to, you know, look, the plan here long term is to get you to the Rumble or to get you to WrestleMania, and the Warrior's going to put you over. I don't know why Bret would have believed that. So who knows? Maybe Bourne was fed a bunch of lies by somebody and he bought into it, but I just cannot believe for a second that there was any real plan on file at any point during the build-up to WrestleMania to do Hogan and Doink. I don't buy it. I mean, what it would have been, what, just a straight-up singles match? I mean, Doink wasn't the champion. Hogan wasn't the champion. So what is he saying? It would have been just Hogan versus Doink one-on-one, no titles or anything on the line? I don't buy that. I don't buy that for a second. He also claimed, by the way, in the past, Bourne did, that he was supposed to work with the British Bulldog, and that Davey Boy rejected the idea as well. What's funny about that is the Bulldog was fired only a few weeks after Doink debuted on TV. Now, I guess it's possible that Crush took Bulldog's place, and it would have been Doink's first feud. It would have been Doink and Davey Boy, but then Davey got fired. Now, in his book, Bret Hart does talk about Doink coming into the company, you know, towards the end of 92. And he mentions that Vince McMahon shooting an angle where Doink beat Davey Boy. But then Davey's wife, Diana, Bret's sister, got in Davey's ear and convinced him, hey, you shouldn't be jobbing to some stupid clown. The problem with that, and I made a note here, I typed in Doink and Davey just to remind myself to look this up before I started recording here today. The problem is I cannot find a single record of a Doink the Clown British Bulldog match from late 1992 after Doink debuted. Not even so much as a house show match. Forget TV matches. As far as I could tell, Bulldog never lost to Doink because he never wrestled him. So I have no idea what Bret is talking about in his book. But I think a short program with Hogan and Doink, as ridiculous as that sounds on the surface... Let's say Hogan wins the championship, as he did at WrestleMania. And let's say he did stick around for a while. He didn't leave so quickly, right? He was going to be there through SummerSlam. And, you know, remember, the plan was he was going to drop the belt to Bret at SummerSlam. And Hogan wasn't feeling it. He nixed that idea. But that had been the plan at one point. I could envision a situation where Hogan and Doink, for the championship, you know, would have worked as a title match in the middle of the card in June at the King of the Ring pay-per-view. You know, I mean, had he not planned to leave and had to drop the belt to Yokozuna, if he was going to hold it, say, until SummerSlam and then drop it to Bret, or whatever the plans may have been, I think a short program with this evil, you know, heel clown challenging Hogan at the King of the Ring, which at the time was a brand new pay-per-view, wasn't one of their big shows of the year, I think that could have worked. I really think that could have worked. I mean, that show was really just built around Bret anyway, winning the tournament. I don't know that you would headline with Hogan and Doink for the championship. I mean, look, they did Hogan and Yokozuna in the middle of the card. Probably because Yoko was going over. That didn't headline the King of the Ring that year. Bret winning headlined the King of the Ring. What harm would there have been had they built Doink up as this real sinister heel in doing Hogan Doink in the middle of the card for the championship, with Doink just tormenting him and tormenting his fans and all the little kids on television in the build-up to that match, you know, coming off a win at WrestleMania against Crush, so at least he'd have a win in his back pocket. It's not so far-fetched when you really stop and think about it. I think that could have worked. I really do. Bourne was so good in that role. He had a lot of issues, drug problems. He was not the nicest person in the world. There's a lot of stories about him, but he was very talented. And in that role, the original Doink, I'm not talking about the fake ones later on, he was pitch perfect in that role. And for anybody who says, well, we can't take the idea seriously of a guy dressed in clown makeup, you know, the Joker did just fine against Batman as one of his main villains. You know, a creepy guy in clown makeup who underneath is some kind of tortured soul, and on top of that is a good worker who could actually wrestle, you know, and can bump for Hogan and do all those things. Yeah, you know what? I think that could have worked.
What did we just see? What did we just see? It's WrestleMania, baby!
The top 10 most shocking WrestleMania match outcomes continues. Last week, it was the Macho King and the Ultimate Warrior career-ending match at WrestleMania 7, and all of the post-match drama that came afterwards. This week, we flash forward for number 7 on the list to Madison Square Garden for WrestleMania 10 and the greatest opening match in WrestleMania history between Bret the Hitman Hart and his brother Owen. One of the greatest WrestleMania matches, period. Not just opening matches. Owen Hart was a great wrestler. I don't think there could be any denying that. Owen Hart was a great wrestler. But on television, that's all he was. When he first joined the company in those early years, he had no personality. He was not able to show his sense of humor, his personality. He was as bland could be from a personality standpoint. He had a run as the Blue Blazer first in the late 80s, left, came back, and was paired off with Jim Neidhart as the new foundation. How original. That lasted all of 2 months before Neidhart got fired. Then came High Energy with Coco Beware. He wrestled in baggy pants, three times too big. Fast forward to 1993. Vince McMahon comes to Bret, says, I got an idea. We're going to do a sibling rivalry storyline. He wants him to feud with one of his brothers, culminating in a match at WrestleMania 10. That brother was not originally supposed to be Owen Hart. Instead, it was going to be Bret's brother, Bruce. And Bret liked the storyline idea, but he was not sold on Bruce being the person for the role, because he knew that Bruce was not the best wrestler of the brothers. He knew Owen was better. And Bruce was also, I think, older and maybe a little more beat up. He wanted Owen for the role, because he knew that, again, Owen was a better wrestler than Bruce, and he just felt like this angle is going to work a lot better, and it would be huge for Owen's career. And he thought he could have better matches with him. So when he suggested Owen initially, Pat Patterson was against the idea. He argued against it. He thought it should be Bruce. Bret stood his ground, and eventually Vince agreed. We would have gotten a very different feud had it been Bruce Hart instead of Owen Hart against Bret. Survivor Series 93, set to be Bret, Owen, Bruce, and Keith, the Hart brothers, with their father, the patriarch, Stu, at ringside in their corner, taking on Jerry Lawler and his knights, his royal knights, since Lawler had been feuding with Bret and mocking his parents for months on television. But then Lawler got indicted on charges of rape and sodomy of an underage girl. They were eventually dropped. Not because the girl recanted, but because she didn't want to testify against Lawler. So the whole thing got dropped. But this happened less than 2 weeks before the pay-per-view. So instead, they reinstated Shawn Michaels, who had been suspended. They reinstated him, and he took Lawler's place, captaining the Knights. It made no sense having Shawn Michaels out there with a bunch of guys in Knight costumes, looking like they're working a night out at fucking medieval times or something. But there it is, Shawn Michaels and the Knights. And if Royal Rumble 92 is Bobby Heenan's greatest performance at the announce desk, which, by the way, it is, then I would argue that this here at Survivor Series 93 might be number two. He spent the entire, and this, by the way, was his last pay-per-view. A few weeks later, he got kicked out of Monday Night Raw. He spent the entire match mercilessly mocking all of the brothers, the entire Hart family, even Stu. Stu was ringside for the match. I think at one point he was yelling. He's like, excuse me. He stood up. He's like yelling, Stu, wake up. Like, just mercilessly going after these guys. Basically taking the mantle from Lawler, who was doing that for months. And I think my favorite line of many, my favorite Heenan line was when Bruce tagged in. And he's talking about Bruce Hart. And he just goes, you know, they had 9 months. And the best they could come up with was Bruce. When I first heard that line, I busted a gut laughing. Bobby was the freaking best, man. But this is where they shot the angle where it started it all. With Owen, he inadvertently hit Brett. He was running the ropes, and Brett was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he collided with his brother and knocked Brett off the apron into the guardrail, and everybody rushes over to Brett. All the other brothers rush over to Brett to check on him to see if he's okay, and all Owen is concerned about, he's not concerned about Brett. He's standing there going, what are you doing? What are you even on the apron for? What are you guys doing? Hey, what about me? And meantime, he gets rolled up and pinned by Shawn Michaels. Owen was the only Hart brother in that match to be eliminated. Everybody else survived except him. And he pitched a fit and he stormed off. And when the match was over and the Harts won, Owen came back out. He grabbed Brett. He shoved him. There was a big shoving match between them. And the funniest part about this, if you go back and you really watch, pay attention to Bruce. You can tell how completely disinterested he is in doing anything, because clearly he's very bitter about Owen getting the spot that was intended for him. I mean, it's you watch this and it's so obvious. Watching it back, he wants no part of this. He's sort of standing off. Then I think he disappeared. He did not want to be there. So after this, Brett and Owen, they patch things up just in time for the holidays, the Christmas holiday. I remember these vignettes of them. Everything's great. We're going to be a tag team now. We're going to challenge the Quebecers for the tag team titles at the Royal Rumble. And they go to the Rumble, and that's where Brett hurt his leg. And, in storyline, he hurt his leg, and they lost the match. And Owen is just furious because now all he wanted was a tag. Brett wouldn't tag. And they lost. And Owen flipped his shit. And of course, that's where he kicked Brett's leg out of his leg after the match. And he challenged Brett to a match. Brett refused. Brett did not want to fight his brother. He just could not bring himself to do it. Clearly, they borrowed from this for the Undertaker and Kane angle in 97 when Kane debuted. And Undertaker refused to even raise a hand to his brother. He would just let Kane beat the shit out of him on television. Refused to wrestle him, refused to fight his brother until finally he did. And of course, that's what happened here. The situation was that Brett was going to have to fight Owen at the beginning of the WrestleMania show and then come back out later in the night and wrestle the winner of the Lex Luger-Yokozuna match. So the point is that either Luger or Brett, one of them, would have to wrestle twice in the same night. So Brett had to face his brother. So they made the match, and that led to one of the more shocking match outcomes in WrestleMania history, with Owen Hart, who had not done squat up to this point in his WWE career, as the Blazer, as High Energy, as the New Foundation, as just the Rocket, Owen Hart. He had done nothing. He was a good wrestler, great wrestler, and that was it. And for the first time, he was finally having the spotlight shone down upon him. And it was shocking that here's a guy who's not done anything. Not only does he beat his brother, a former tag team champion, IC champion, WWF champion, Royal Rumble winner, King of the Ring winner. Brett did it all. Maybe only the second true Grand Slam winner in the company, second only to Pedro Morales, who I just got done talking about last week. Brett did it all. All the different accomplishments that you could do, he did. And here's Owen Hart, not only beating him, but pinning him clean to open the show at WrestleMania. This guy who is going to wrestle for the championship later that night in the main event is pinned by his little brother. And that victory roll finish that they did in the corner was so great. The victory roll counter, such a great finish. And it's just too bad that Owen had that big wad of spit on the side of his mouth when the match was over. When Todd Pettengill interviewed him backstage when he came through the curtain, he still hadn't wiped it away. You would think that the referee or somebody would have told him about it, but who knows? Owen was a prankster. For all I know, he did it on purpose. Maybe he wanted it there. But Owen pinning Brett was shocking. You know, I don't know how shocking it would be today. It does make sense that he would beat Brett to set himself up as a challenger for the championship coming out of WrestleMania that summer, which is what they did. It does make sense. It shouldn't be all that shocking, I guess, when you really stop and think about it. But it was. It shocked the hell out of me as a kid. It shocked the hell out of a lot of other people, too. Shocked the hell out of that crowd at the Garden. The man who would go on to win the world title later on that night was pinned clean at the start of the show. And it was great, too, because when Brett won the championship and they had the big celebration in the ring, Owen walked back out. He never got into the ring, but he stood in the aisle. They got a big close-up of his face, and you could see him be like, what about me? He was appalled. I beat you. Why is the attention still on you? Why are you the champion? I should be the champion. It was a great story. It really was. And Brett had not been pinned clean like that in the middle of the ring since probably the Bulldog pinned him at Wembley Stadium at SummerSlam 2 years earlier. Brett only lost the title to Yokozuna at WrestleMania 9 because Fuji threw salt in his eyes. Otherwise, Brett hadn't really lost that I could think of. I can't remember another match he just lost fair and square during that run. They actually protected him pretty well, all things considered. But this put Owen on the map. This made him a star in one night. Brett made his brother's career by putting him over. No wonder Bruce was upset. I would be too if I were him. But the younger brother living in the shadow of his older brother, it's an easy story, I think, for people with siblings to buy into. A lot of people can relate. I mean, not me. I am the older brother. My brother is 4.5 years younger than me. He'll never outgrow my shadow. He knows that. I mean, I'm the Sala Monster. Come on now. But it's an easy story, I think, that people can relate to. And one of the all-time great storylines that they've really ever done, I think, in the company. Owen beating Brett is just one of the greatest upsets in WWE history. It was a brilliant angle. It led to the King of Hearts gimmick for Owen. And when he won the King of the Ring, the greatest steel cage match in WWE history at SummerSlam that year. That's my favorite cage match. And so I can't say enough good things about what they did here. So that's the countdown for this week, number 7, as we move along. Don't forget that all of these segments go up every Wednesday. There is a brand new playlist on the YouTube channel labeled Top 10, you know, Most Shocking Match Outcomes in WrestleMania History. And so if you miss one, or you want to refer back to it, they're all going to be, as we go along here, organized in order, in rank order, in a playlist every Wednesday on the YouTube channel. And I've also started a brand new retro countdown every Friday on YouTube. A new clip will go up from my old countdown of the top 15 WCW matches of all time. That was a countdown that I started back in late 2015, building to the 15-year anniversary of the death of WCW. I focus on the good. I didn't want to waste my time with the bad. I get enough of that. I talk enough about bad negative stuff every week. When I do these countdowns, I like to focus on the good stuff. Because if I'm going to go back and rewatch a lot of this shit, I don't want to go back and watch bad wrestling. I can't tell you how many people want me to do, oh, why don't you do a worst matches review? Why don't you do a worst this and a worst that? I have to watch Monday Night Raw every week. Haven't I suffered enough? Why are you being so masochistic with me? The WCW countdown was great, and I'm going to go through 15 of the best matches in that company. If you didn't hear the countdown, if you're a newer listener, you're going to really love this. The first clip is already up on YouTube, and there'll be a new one going up the next 14 weeks every Friday. It's Retro Friday on the YouTube channel, so Please go and sub if you are not already subbed to the channel. I am also going to be getting an event invite up this week, so you know, FYI, on Facebook. If you would be so kind as to RSVP for our WrestleMania weekend meetup. It is going to be on Friday, April 5th, the Friday before WrestleMania. That is the night, the day of the NXT TakeOver show at the Barclays Center. We are doing it at our old spot that we've done a bunch of times before in Brooklyn, in Park Slope. It's the KBH, King's Beer Hall. It is literally, I think, a four-block walk to the Barclays Center. So we're going to do it at 2 p.m. that Friday, straight through pretty much until 6:30, when people are going to go to the NXT show. I'm going to the NXT show. We could all walk over to the arena. And so that is going to be the date for our meetup that weekend. I'll get an invite up on Facebook now, and so you can start to RSVP so I can get a sense of headcount. I hope to see you all there. I hope to see a whole bunch of you WrestleMania weekend. New York is going to be a madhouse. I guess New York and New Jersey. It's going to be a crazy time that weekend, so I look forward to that. I'm out of here. I'm exhausted. This is a long freaking show, and I talked about a lot of shit this week. So again, if you skipped over some stuff or you missed it, you've got all week. You can go back and play catch up and plenty of audio there for you. I will be back with a brand new episode. That'll be 588 coming up next weekend here on the road to 600. Until then, be well, stay safe. Thank you as always for your support and your kind words for Jinx. And I will see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
You know what annoyed me more than anything else on this show last Monday night? Instead of just calling it Fastlane, they called it WWE Fastlane.
At WWE Fastlane, I'm going to beat you.
Drove me nuts.
You and I are going to have a match at WWE Fastlane.
All night with this. Who talks like that? If aliens landed on Earth and attempted to engage a member of the WWE roster in a conversation, you know what they would think? Holy shit, these creatures are stupid. And then they would exterminate every last one of us.
The Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monster Sound Off.